Bonds was stolen, and Ronnie Biggs was the most famous face of the great train robbery.
Daniel Mays reveals the true story of Ronnie Biggs.
A train robbery, a prison escape, and 36 years on the run.
Gangster presents The Story of Ronnie Biggs.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday the 17th of May. This is Charles Carroll. Good morning. The World Health Organization has declared an Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo to be a public health emergency of international concern. 87 people are now thought to have died, and health experts say this strain of the virus has no vaccine or specific treatment. The WHO said it was not classing this as a pandemic, but it warned of the international spread of the disease. Our correspondent, Shingai Nyoko, reports from Harare.
The numbers of the dead and sick have been rising rapidly since this outbreak was declared. Just over 330 people are now suspected of having contracted Ebola, mainly in two gold mining border towns, where it's feared that high population movement could spread the disease further. The African Union's Public Health Agency has called for an increase in cross-border monitoring after Uganda confirmed its first fatality. The 59-year-old man had recently travelled from the DRC. Initial tests suggest that this is a rare strain of the virus with no vaccine available for it.
The cruise ship, which has been at the centre of a deadly hantavirus outbreak, is expected to dock in Rotterdam in the Netherlands this evening. The MV Hondius is still carrying more than 25 crew and medics. The passengers were evacuated in an operation off Tenerife. Police Scotland say they had to deal with unacceptable violence last night as fans gathered in Glasgow to celebrate Celtic's premiership win. Hearts, who were pipped of the title when they were beaten by Celtic in their final match of the season, say they're working with police to investigate if any players or staff were assaulted when a pitch invasion brought the game to a sudden end. The build-up to the game had gripped fans, with Hearts hoping to be the first club from outside Glasgow to win the title in more than four decades. Our Scotland correspondent Katie Hunter reports.
Police said around 3,000 people made their way to the Trongate area of Glasgow following yesterday afternoon's match between Celtic and Hearts. Dozens of riot police lined up as the celebrations turned to trouble. Police Scotland said missiles, including glass bottles, were thrown at officers and a number were injured. Assistant Chief Constable Mark Sutherland described the level of criminal behaviour as simply unacceptable. Officers are also liaising with Hearts Football Club to establish if any of their players were assaulted following a pitch invasion around full-time. Hearts said it utterly condemned the shameful scenes at Celtic Park yesterday afternoon, which in its words have once again embarrassed Scottish football.
Russian officials say that a drone attack overnight has killed three people near Moscow. Ukraine has regularly launched long-range strikes on the capital region. The government is exploring whether the north of England could host the Olympic and Paralympic Games. An assessment's been commissioned by UK Sport, which could lead to a bid in the 2040s. The process will look at the costs, benefits and likelihood of success of any application. Here's our sports correspondent, Patrick Geary.
It's 14 years since London 2012, British sport's great spectacular, and now the government wants the Games back. This time they've commissioned an assessment to look at holding the Olympics and Paralympics across the north of England. Lisa Nandy, the Culture Secretary who represents Wigan in Parliament, says the region has already shown it can host big sporting occasions and deserves to hold the Games. Any bid would aim to develop existing facilities rather than committing to spending big sums on new venues. The initial assessment could be followed by a feasibility study, but a final decision on whether to bid would be made by the British Olympic and Paralympic Associations.
Despite the run-up to last night's Eurovision Song Contest in Vienna being overshadowed by several nations boycotting it because of Israel's involvement, the country's entry finished in second place. Much of its support came from the public vote. The UK came last, receiving just 1 point from the jury. The surprise winner was the Bulgarian entry, Bangaranga, by Dara, and she was shocked by her victory.
Since I started doing music, my mission was to unite people, so that's why I felt like home here. This is unbelievable. I don't even know what's going on right now. But I want to thank everybody who felt the Bangaranga and felt connected to the force.
And one of Britain's best-loved sopranos, Dame Felicity Lott, has died at the age of 79. She announced earlier this month that she had terminal cancer. Dame Felicity made her operatic debut in 1974 and went on to perform at Glyndebourne and at concert halls around the world, singing works by composers including Mozart and Richard Strauss. BBC News.
Charles Carroll, many thanks. And the soprano Dame Felicity Lott spoke to John Wilson about her distinguished career in Thursday's This Cultural Life. You can hear that interview again on BBC Sounds. Coming up next here on BBC Radio 4 in Beyond Belief, Giles Fraser and his panel discuss different faith perspectives on the place of graveyards and burial in our society. Then, in half an hour, we meet David McVeigh, who let his kids take over the farm when the youngest was just 17. 11 years on, he reflects on the successes, failures, and why he did not step in when things went wrong. That's on this week's On Your Farm in half an hour.
Will you promise me something? Love differently.
I promise.
The stories of Gertrude Jekyll, Ellen Wilmot, and Beatrix Potter.
You are not above the garden. You are of it.
Do not wait for permission.
And never apologise.
Three female horticulturalists who chose to resist convention, redraw boundaries, and follow their passion.
When you look up at the night sky, I shall be there.
Featuring Juliet Stevenson.
What survives is to have made something honest.
Trimorous. Three Heroines Unearthed begins on Tuesday afternoon at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now on BBC Radio 4, time for Beyond Belief.
Now, this is a particularly beautiful crossroads here in the middle of Kensal Green Cemetery. We're very lucky to have come on a beautiful day. This is a haven for wildlife, isn't it?
It is, yes. I mean, I just love being here in the natural world and it's peaceful. If you stand or sit here on a quiet day in spring, you can hear so much birdsong. It's just wonderful.
Yeah. That was me with Dr. Joanna Holmes, OBE, Chair of the Friends of Kensal Green Cemetery, to discover some of this graveyard's hidden delights.
The oldest part of the cemetery is quite wooded, a lot of open green meadow type vegetation. It's quite densely populated with graves and monuments, and some of them extremely interesting and striking.
Yeah. I mean, you've got just a short, you know, opportunity to say something about who you are, what you think you did,
yes,
and so forth. So it's not just a sort of a Bible quote or something like that.
No. And in fact, many people who come here are surprised by the lack of Christian crosses, because that was absolutely not the fashion when this cemetery first started.
Is that right?
It was very much make a statement.
This is one of the Magnificent Seven, isn't it?
Is,
can you tell
yes.
me about the Magnificent Seven?
Yes, it's a phrase which was coined in the 1990s, I think, to refer to the ring of cemeteries which were built in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s even, around London as it then was, in order to relieve the pressure on the burial grounds of the city churches, which by that time were full to overflowing.
So burial became a sort of municipal type of thing. People came to be buried largely in these sorts of
It became a public and commercial sort of thing.
Commercial?
But, oh yes, the company, in fact, which still owns Kensal Green Cemetery, is the original cemetery company, the only one left in the UK, which is still in business. This burial ground, too, is filling up.
Right.
And when it became evident that that was going to be a problem, they built the crematorium in order to be a new source of income. But, of course, by that time, fashions were changing anyway. And there is a distinct trend towards people being cremated rather than buried in the soil.
It's a really big space, and you can wander around and have that peaceful, there's nature here, there's all these sort of people that, famous people that are lying
yes.
here.
Why does everybody go to Highgate?
Highgate, huh. And so Thackeray's here.
Yes.
And Pinter.
Yes.
And, like, I mean, Sidney Smith, the great Sidney Smith.
Great Sidney Smith and many more great men.
Most mornings I share my coffee with the dead. I sit alone in the church's graveyard, enjoy the gentle tranquility that gathers there and contemplate the meaning of life. Graveyards provide much-needed perspective. One day I too will be in a place like this. Someone may erect a headstone with a few nicely chosen words, and then, over time, even this stone will fall apart and return to the earth. Today we're thinking about graveyards, tombs and monuments, how they represent our thinking about the dead, or whether it's changed, and how they should be preserved or perhaps left to decay. Joining me to think further about this fascinating issue, Madeline Pennington, head of research at the religious think tank Theos, and she wrote a report in 2023, Love, Grief and Hope, Emotional Responses to Death and Dying in the UK. Welcome to you, Maddie.
Hello, good to be here.
Peter Ross is a Glasgow-based author, journalist and blogger, and he wrote a book called A Tomb with a View, Stories of the Glories of Graveyards. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here talking about one of my favourite subjects.
And Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg, he's the senior rabbi of Masorti Judaism in the UK and a leading writer and thinker on Judaism. Rabbi Jonathan, very nice to have you here.
Thank you for including me before I join a graveyard.
We all will do that. So, Peter, you've written this great book. Tell me about what inspired it. What is it about graveyards that have been so important to you and inspired you?
I mean, when I was a child, I was very drawn to them. I think some people just have a natural affinity for these places. And I remember as a little boy going to the Old Town Cemetery in Stirling, where I was born, and admiring the sort of 17th century gravestones there. They're wonderful works of kind of folk art, I think. You know, they've got those skulls and hourglasses and scythes and things on them. And I remember poking my little fingers into like the sockets of the stone skulls. So it really started really started young for me. But then as I grew older, I moved to a house in the south side of Glasgow, and there's a cemetery behind my house, and I chanced upon a gravestone on which were written the words Mark Sheridan, comedian. I had never seen the word comedian on a gravestone before, and so I started to do some research, and it turned out that Mark Sheridan was an Edwardian music hall star who had had a huge popular success with I Do Like to Be Beside the Seaside. And I think that that's really one of the great attractions for me in cemeteries, is that they are libraries of the dead, so to speak. They're places where one can go and encounter wonderful or sometimes just common stories and feel kind of connected to the people that have gone before.
Rabbi Jonathan, I wonder if I can bring you in. Some of the great Jewish cemeteries of Europe are some of the most beautiful and powerful places there are, really.
I absolutely relate to what's been said, both the presence of nature, the singing of birds, the sense that one stepped out of an over-busy, rushing world of time measured in minutes into a world of quiet and time measured in eternity. And there one encounters the past, one reads the history of the gravestones, one thinks of the people buried there, their lives. There, many of those cemeteries contained the graves of some of the great sages of Judaism. And as well as the nature, then one has this feeling, and I'm reading and finding out my own history.
It's terribly important. I mean, Kensal Green, where I spent yesterday, this is 77 acres in the middle of Kensington and Chelsea. You know? And there weren't very many people there. I mean, really very few. And you have this space, but also you're absolutely right. Time changes when you're in that place. You suddenly see yourself sub specie aeternitatis.
Yeah, and I've gone sometimes also to visit some of my teachers. There's some dates in the Jewish year when it's traditional to visit a cemetery, the fast of the 9th of Av, when one remembers all kinds of destruction. And I took a group around the Hoop Lane Cemetery, where all my parents and all my family are buried. And we talked about the graves of some of the teachers there, their lives. Many of them had fled to Britain from Nazi Europe. And you sense that you're both in nature and in history and outside of time, all of this simultaneously.
Maddie, is that what you found with your research, that there was something about graveyards that took you into a different place?
Well, our research was focused really primarily on sort of what's happening to before people get to graveyards and I suppose largely decline of formal funerals and decline of burial. The way we grieve is just changing so much. In 2019, 3% of send-offs, as it were direct cremations. So it was 3% in 2019. It's now 21%.
Wow.
So this is really, really recent.
So 21%, what happens in those 21%?
Essentially, you don't have attenders at the cremation. Sometimes the body, I think, basically goes straight from the morgue to the crematorium, and it might be taken way across the country. You don't necessarily even know where your loved one is when they're being cremated, and then the ashes are simply returned to the family. And it's largely driven by cost. So we found that fewer than half of people now want a funeral, and the cost of funerals has gone up and up and up. So that's one thing that's driving it. The other thing that's driving it is secularisation, and even bigger than cost was the difference between people who worship regularly and people who don't. So 76% of frequent worshippers wanted a funeral compared to 38% of those who never attend worship.
Rabbi, I wonder if I could bring you in, just ask you about your reaction to that. I'm just pretty aghast that people don't want...
I'm amazed because in the Jewish community, people who keep very little of their Judaism want a Jewish burial. And there's that biblical phrase, to be gathered to one's people, to be in a place of rest that is a Jewish place of rest, that one feels I am with my community, is enormously important to people. There are some people who do want to be cremated, but traditional funerals are still very, very frequent. And they're very important, and many of them are extremely well attended because accompanying the dead to their resting place is a mitzvah. It's understood as a commandment to honour the memory of the dead.
There was a news story that came out in about January that there are 300,000 urns of ashes that have been unclaimed. Peter, we went round Kensal Green yesterday and there were some vast, great big edifices to the dead. Mm-hmm. This really does represent a massive change, doesn't it, from our Victorian forebears to leaving ashes at the undertakers?
Oh, it's absolutely enormous. I mean, I think the figures are that around 78% of Britons are now cremated, and that figure seems to rise a little every time the statistics are gathered. So we're certainly in a situation now where people who are sort of nominally Christian and people who have no religious faith are mostly no longer being laid to rest in cemeteries. And certainly in my local cemetery, which is a big 19th century garden cemetery, it's quite unusual for there to be a burial now, and therefore much of that cemetery is quiet and rather overgrown, except for in the areas given over to Jewish and to Muslim graves. In those areas, burials take place regularly, and the graves are much visited and well tended. I think Islamic law states that a body must be buried as soon as possible, and I think cremation is forbidden. But certainly these things are having a huge impact on the way our cemeteries look. And if you go to a sort of modern Muslim cemetery, as I did, the actual architecture of the graveyard is very different as well. All of the graves were identical. They were marked with a mound of earth and a simple square of black stone with the name and the age of the deceased. And in some ways, actually, that's very like what you sometimes see in natural burial grounds, sometimes known as woodland burial grounds, where the person's sort of presence is perhaps indicated only by a piece of slate with a name, because it's not about, you know, making your mark, making any kind of statement in the landscape. It's about sort of humbly going back to the earth.
Rabbi Jonathan, can we talk about burials in Judaism? And we've heard it there mentioned in Islam as well.
So very similar. The tradition is to bury as soon as reasonably possible, allowing time for close relatives to arrive. So often it'll be 24 to 48 hours afterwards. And the body also needs to be treated with respect. The Chevra Kadisha, which is lately the sacred society entrusted with washing and dressing the body in the traditional linen, simple white garments, there's a moment of sort of equality in death. They say a prayer of apology to the body. We are treating you as best we can. A prayer of permission to the body. And then the burial is quite quick. But the gravestones matter a lot. And in the cemetery for my community, there is a limited height, and they're very similar to avoid extravagance. And there's a tradition to mark with the name, the date, some simple inscription, but there's an understanding that the real testament to how a person lived is the memories of what they have done in their life and not the lines on a gravestone.
Maddie.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing that sort of focus away from the sort of personalisation of the gravestones there. So I'm a Quaker, and Quakers are another group of people who don't like personalisations of graves particularly. There's a sort of Quaker testimony to equality, we call it. And in a traditional Quaker graveyard, then all of the gravestones will be identical and you're only really allowed your name and date. Although there is a Quaker graveyard round the corner from where I live. In one of them, it says, of Eden Place, it's an address, which is a quite useful way of signalling wealth, as it happens, because it's a very big address. But the point of that is to make a group statement that equality is important to us. So it's sort of saying, as a community, we stand for this. One of my favourite Quaker graveyards is Jordan's graveyard, where, in fact, the graves are also arranged in circles concentrically. So essentially, the dead are forever in the formation of a Quaker meeting.
Peter, this is really interesting, this business about headstones being all the same.
Yes.
When I went round Kensal Green yesterday, oh my word, there are some vast, great big things. There was a guy called Andrew Ducrow, who was a circus performer in the 19th century. And he has this thing with angels and Egyptian seraphs, and it's sort of a great big thing, and it describes him as a genius. And there is something rather beautiful to hear Rabbi Jonathan and Maddie talk about this sort of democracy of death. But not all memorials respect that idea.
No, I think probably the most striking and surprising memorial I ever saw in the UK was actually in Kensal Green Cemetery. I mean, I had been walking around in there, as you did, for a while, and I could well understand why it's described as England's Valhalla, or, you know, the Belgravia of death is another way they describe it. And I always think that walking in Kensal Green is to sort of sense the energy and industry and the sort of economic power of the 19th century as an almost palpable force. But actually, the grave that caught my eye was much more recent. It was that of a boy who had died in a riding accident at the age of 11 in 2014. And his father, an Iranian businessman, had built a memorial for him on a scale that those Victorians would recognise. It's a kind of mausoleum constructed in a half circle with Corinthian columns and carvings of Christian and Islamic symbols and a beautiful garden planted within it. And there's also like a life-size statue of the boy inside, sitting on a bench, wearing a school uniform and holding a football. I don't think there's anything else quite like it in Britain. And the reason I bring it up is because it seems to me to carry the spirit of the 19th century into the 21st. This idea that the intensity of your grief could be expressed through the most ostentatious and costly architecture. The sheer scale and flash of the memorial speaks to the pain of the loss.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that as well. Chesterton famously wrote, "For there is good news yet to hear and fine things to be seen before we go to paradise by way of Kensal Green."
Ah. it's interesting to listen to this because there are grand graves in Jewish history. I've seen some in sort of Central Europe where it feels like a small CV on the gravestone. But much more traditionally, there's a classic iconography of gravestones. A broken tree represents someone who died before their time. Hands spread out would indicate a priest, a Kohen, with the gesture of blessing the community. A laver, a pitcher of water, would indicate a Levite whose role was to wash the hands of the priests. My father was a great blower of the shofar, the ram's horn. So we had the image of the ram's horn on the gravestone, just very small, because that was who he was. And I think there is something about getting a sense, who was this person, but in a modest, not an ostentatious way.
I mean, I guess for Judaism, one of the things that's there is the fact that the pyramids were sort of memorials to the sort of pharaohs, and they were a part of the story of enslavement for the Jewish people.
Yeah. As you say that, something different perspective goes through my mind, which is so many people in my generation and before me, their family had no graves. There were ashes in some field behind Auschwitz-Birkenau or Treblinka. And therefore, the honouring of a resting place really matters.
Maddie, the honouring of a resting place really matters. That's just made me feel quite emotional. Did you find when you did your work about the changing emotional perspectives on death and dying? Can you give us some sense of what's going on out there now?
Well, I mean, I share that sentiment. It's just so moving and tragic to think of people who do not have that dignity in death. I think one of the things which is going on today is some move away from really thinking that it's that important that the body is honoured after life. The lasting feeling I had having done that research with Theos was we're really quite confused on this as a society, and we're allowing ourselves to let market forces make these decisions for us. Funerals are expensive, so we don't have them. Whereas really this is a values issue.
But they are expensive. Have a listen to this.
Have you earmarked yourself a little plot? Here?
No. I can't afford one.
Oh, were they expensive?
Even if I wanted
How
to
much
be
are
buried.
They, then?
25,000 Parkside and...
So £25,000?
Just for the plot.
Whoa.
And 20,000 deeper into the...
Wow. And how long do you get for that?
Well, originally you got in perpetuity, forever. But nowadays I think you get 75 years.
I'm very interested in the way in which these open spaces, they are crumbling, and a number of the monuments there, people don't know who the relatives are, so there's no one there to keep them up. And there is a sense that, although this is legally tricky, the property developers are circling. Mm-hmm. Do you feel a sense of threat about graveyards?
Absolutely. I mean, they have a lot of problems, and often if they're council and the councils that own them don't have enough money for their proper upkeep, there is often a development threat. I mean, that was certainly the case with Arnos Vale Cemetery in Bristol, for example, which faced closure in the 1990s, but it was saved by a campaigning group of local people, and now it's actually a really good example of a cemetery that's found a new purpose and a new way of being. People are still buried there, which I think is important because that's almost the sort of heartbeat of the cemetery, if you like. But there are also guided tours, there's a nice cafe, there are film screenings and other events, and they even hold weddings in one of the restored chapels. So all of those provide income for the upkeep of the place, and having so many visitors makes it feel like a kind of loved space and a safe space rather than a bit of a no-go area, which I think some places are in danger of becoming.
Jonathan, I just wanted to know, as it were, one sort of religious professional to another, how you deal with the idea that after 200 or 300 years these monuments fall apart. And do you allow people to be buried on top of them? Are they...
Sometimes Jewish communities have had no choice. I think in Venice, in Prague, a very limited area assigned to the Jewish community for burial. And I think there, over the centuries, as many as 20 layers of burial. I think people assume, and understandably from a Jewish point of view, that this is in perpetuity, but perpetuity may not mean quite that.
Yeah, 75 years apparently means in Kensal Green. One of the things I do like about graveyards and this relationship between the dead and the living is that you do actually get the sense that the dead are protecting open space for the living. Peter?
That's a fantastic way to put it, I think. Yeah. I think the presence of the dead in these places is really important. I remember during the COVID pandemic, my family and I would take our daily exercise in the cemetery behind our house. And you might think that at a time when so many people were dying, a cemetery would be the last place you would want to spend time. But I actually found the presence of the dead a comfort, almost neighbourly, if I can put it that way. You sort of sense the arm around your shoulder and the kind of quiet word in your ear whispering that everything's going to be okay. And I don't think you necessarily have to have a religious faith to feel that. There's something, I think, about the knowledge of being surrounded by thousands of people who have gone through the troubles and pleasures of life that is consoling and steadying. And that's perhaps the sort of spiritual importance of cemeteries in its widest sense. They make us aware of our life, our human spirit, and that we are part of a continuum, you know. I mean, one day we will lie there where we now walk, but for now, we can you know, we can enjoy that bird song and the daylight and the stories on the stones.
Of course, it's sort of slightly different when it comes to nighttime, isn't it? Because the whole sort of gothic imagination is born out of graveyards being scary and spooky places. Are we losing that, Maddie?
Yeah, I wonder whether actually maybe our society as a whole, we're just so bad at dealing with death. And graveyards, for some of us, have that sense of, you know, this is somewhere that we can come and still have, as you put it, that sense of perspective. Actually, society as a whole, death is sort of increasingly behind closed doors in institutions. People much more often die in hospitals now than at home. And I think whether or not graveyards themselves are seen as the sort of nighttime gothic imagination spooky, people do still feel very uncomfortable about death, don't they? So I would say it's certainly still part of our cultural treatment of death, and in fact possibly a growing part of our cultural treatment of death, that it is seen as sort of best not to think about it too much.
Rabbi Jonathan.
I very much relate to some of this, what was said, and I think we have the assumption that we live among the living. But when I go to the area of our community cemetery where I've officiated many funerals, here are my friends, some of them my contemporaries, many of them the parents of my friends. These are my roots. These are the people who nourished me. So the sense that I live only among the living, I also live with the voices of the dead. And those voices are not dead inside me. They're vital inside me. They nourish me. I would always begin, when I was working in the community, before the Jewish high holidays, by taking a group to the cemetery. And I would comment in one of my sermons that there they are with us, speaking to us, guiding us. So we live both with the generation of the living, but we live with the voices of the dead.
Of course.
And we pass our voices on to the next generations. And people go to talk to their beloved dead. And I think sometimes I sometimes go to listen. I don't know what be said. I don't expect a voice to come from under the ground. It's not that at all. I want to quieten myself so that I can hear their voices in my heart.
Now, when I was in Kensal Green, I came across the tomb of one of my heroes. Is this it here?
That's it.
Oh, come on.
So this is one of my favourite inscriptions in the cemetery. Not a very ostentatious tomb, a few rows back from the path. Hard to find unless you know what you're looking for. But it is absolutely what I would like to think that people thought about me.
It's fabulous. So one of my heroes, this chap, the Reverend Sydney Smith. And it says, one of the best of men, his talents, though admitted by his contemporaries to be great, were surpassed by his unostentatious benevolence, his fearless love of truth, and his endeavour to promote the happiness of mankind by religious toleration and rational freedom. He was a canon residentiary of St. Paul's Cathedral, made in 1831, as was I for a while. And he died February 22nd, 1845. And this is lovely. Sidney Smith was this sort of like very funny, very caustic and much loved cleric. What a great thing this is. Thank you for showing me this, Joanna.
I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, I really do. Maddie, you're not going to have much on your gravestone because you're a Quaker, so that'll be modest. And Rabbi Jonathan, you may have something about being a priest, but it'll be reasonably modest. But Peter, will you have something a bit more exuberant, do you think?
Well, I suppose it depends what part of my personality is dominant by that time in my life, whether it's, you know, whether it's a narcissism or something a bit more humble, you know, because I am quite drawn in a way to the grand Victorian tomb.
Narcissism is a bit weird when you're dead, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah, yeah. But as a writer, of course, I couldn't afford it. So I think I might just go for the natural burial. I like the idea of being on a hillside somewhere with a nice view.
I must confess myself to be slightly shocked at some of the things that we've said today, just hearing about how few people want to have that sort of memorialisation. I thought that was an instinct that was deep in all of us. So I'll go away and contemplate what I've heard today. Thank you so much to those who've come and joined in this conversation. Maddie Pennington, Peter Ross and Rabbi Jonathan Wittenberg. Thank you to you all.
Beyond Belief was presented by Giles Fraser. It was produced by Catherine Longworth. Next week, the final programme in the series explores the faith of Bob Dylan. Coming up next, we meet the kids who took over the farm. And then in half an hour, after the news and papers, Sunday takes a look at the ethical and religious issues of the week. Today's topics, faith and politics, street preachers, and a Holocaust memorial lecture. Sunday is at 7:10.
On BBC iPlayer.
I want to win.
They're on a journey into the unknown.
I'm feeling very confident.
We only have to win one leg.
I like that attitude, Mark.
A race of more than 12,000 kilometres.
Every little mistake you make could cost you.
The further they go...
This is it.
Let's go.
The closer they'll get.
Both of us have grown and we see the true value in each other.
Race across the world. The finale.
There's no reason why we can't win this race.
On Thursday on BBC iPlayer.
Time now for On Your Farm with Anna Hill.
11 years ago, I came here to Kenton Hall in Suffolk, home of the McVeigh family, to meet the three children who'd been given the opportunity by their parents, David and Sharon, to take over parts of the farm. It's a relatively small arable enterprise, but it does have a lot of diversification. Agroforestry, cookery school, glamping, and hen parties. Well, back in 2015, Tom was just 17. His sisters Emily and Lucy were in their late teens and early 20s. 11 years on, after a very steep learning curve, the kids have basically taken over the farm. Today, I'm back to see what's changed, what stayed the same, what succeeded, and what failed. David and Sharon, come here, come and have a chat with me. So David, was there a lot of trepidation handing over the reins at an early stage? Because the children then, Tom was what, 17, wasn't he?
I suppose there was, but they grew up with it. I grew up with it as well. I think it's always something that just moves. And hopefully if it's going forward, you go along with it.
Yes, they've been an interesting few years, really, and they seem to be making their own way now on the farm, which seems to work really well.
How much of a helping hand did they get along the way, David? And how much did you decide not to step in if there were mistakes made?
I suppose that was a difficult bit, getting that balance right. Just enough to encourage them, but not enough to criticise them. I think that was very important. My father didn't criticise me, and I muchly appreciated that. And so I was hoping to do the same thing with my children, and it's worked.
Well, we're going to meet the children in a minute, but first of all, tell me a little bit about the farm. It's not a huge farm, is it? It's an arable-based farm with a beautiful house in the middle, but it's not the sort of farm you might imagine four livelihoods being supported by.
No, that's absolutely right. When I came here, it was 460 acres, but it had the potential to basically have different enterprises on it. I was very lucky in the early days to appreciate that I could go forward with commercial rents on some of the redundant buildings. That created some cash, and then we built more assets, built more cash, built more assets, and it went on from there.
You've got a good business head, David, hasn't he, Sharon?
Absolutely.
But yeah. You're the mum, you're the supporter, you work just as hard as anyone else here. How did you feel for your children when David said, oh, let's get them to work?
A bit nervous, I think, probably initially. But I always felt he was a very safe pair of hands to keep them educated and sorted out.
Tom went to Reading.
He did,
agribusiness,
yes.
He did. Didn't he? Lucy and Emily?
Emily didn't go anywhere. Emily wanted to stay here. And she's learnt on the job, which is probably University of Life. And Lucy went up to Norwich and did business studies. So that worked really well. They're good heads on their shoulders.
Yeah. And how's it been managing the family? Both Emily and Lucy are married.
Yeah.
Lucy has two daughters.
Yeah.
Tom isn't yet married, but he's looking out. But you're the person who's had to keep everything going, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah, and keep the peace to a large degree some of the time, yeah.
I mean, what's the status now? We talk a lot about succession, don't we? Inheritance tax, all that sort of stuff. Whose farm is it now?
Well, certainly not ours. It was about 5 years ago. I stopped opening the post. When I stopped opening the post, I had no idea what was going on. And quite honestly, I didn't want to know what was going on anymore. It was their responsibility, not mine.
You see, that is real trust, isn't it? There are a lot of farmers who won't hand over the keys, let alone the chequebook, and actually let the younger generation take responsibility.
In my case, it was a very small chequebook that I handed over. So in that respect, it was quite easy. Now, the children basically have got their own enterprises and they know what it takes to be viable, and they put the effort in to make it viable. It's been a wonderful run for us to see how they've approached it and the success that they've made of each enterprise.
Well, that's what we're going to do. We're going to explore the success, as you say, of each enterprise. But we're also going to hear a little bit about the ups and the downs. Sharon, I have to say, at the end of the last programme, you said, I hope my daughters become happily married.
Yeah, and now they are. Isn't that wonderful? Absolutely great. Yeah.
Did I make it happen?
Yes, it's all down to you. Absolutely, yeah.
Hopefully you find us a daughter-in-law as well.
Oh, okay. we'll see what we can do. We're not really in the business, but there we go. Behind us here is a very, very smart triangle of a house, a lodge. What was here before was a Mongolian yurt,
it was,
wasn't it?
It was, yes.
So things have changed, things have moved on. So, Emily, you've brought us into your what used to be the Mongolian yurt, but actually, gosh, I could live here. This is really, really nice, isn't it?
Yeah, so we're over here in the glamping site, and over the past 10 years it's developed from just two accommodation units to lodge tents, a large kitchen area, shepherd's hut, and the A-frame that we're in today, and we can sleep 20. And it's sort of pivoted from being accommodation for weddings to, in its own right, hosting hen parties, Duke of Edinburgh Gold residential courses, which we run throughout the summer, July and August.
Well, we're walking upstairs. Oh gosh, it feels so cozy up here, doesn't it? Look at that. Such a high triangular ceiling. And the pine smells beautiful, and you've got a beautiful bedstead here. And looking out through the double doors. Oh, I see, you've got a balcony.
Yes.
So you just step out, and I literally could possibly reach out and touch the trees from here. It's amazing, isn't it? I'm interested about the Duke of Edinburgh scheme and the fact that you do residential courses here. How does that work?
Yeah, so that's actually been a relatively new enterprise. We've only been running courses for about 3 years now. This will be our third summer. And we just noticed there was a bit of a gap for a combined cookery and field to fork course. So we have a cookery school on the site, which I'm going to show you a bit later. They do cookery in the mornings, and then in the afternoons we do a whole range of activities from archery to axe throwing to foodie sessions, making cheese. During the course they stay here in the glamping site and they head up to the cookery school. They have bikes and they bike around the estate. And what we found is it's a really fantastic opportunity to get kids from all over the country, and they all come together. They don't know each other, and by the end of the week they leave as friends. So for us it's been about combining the cookery element to doing them farm tours and learning about all the different things that we're doing on the farm. And they have a farm tour with Tom who talks about soil health and the regenerative farming practices that we're doing here. So it's a really good eye-opener for them.
So we're going off to see the cookery school. You used to do weddings though. That's what we were talking about last time, wasn't it?
Yes, we did weddings for 10 years and we kind of hit pause a little bit on those. I found that a lot of farms around locally started diversifying into weddings, and it just became harder and harder to get the numbers of weddings each summer. And the Duke of Edinburgh and the hen parties were really thriving, and I just decided to kind of adapt.
It's interesting, David, isn't it? So that's a good example, isn't it, of flexibility.
It's an absolute must, isn't it, to look to the future and see what your future plans are best suited to, rather than get stuck in a rut.
Right, here we are. Well, we've come down to your food hub and cookery school, which is another building down the driveway away from Kenton Hall. And last time we were here, this had been built. It was working, wasn't it?
It was. We just opened the cookery school and it's thriving. We run two courses a week, a Wednesday evening course and a Saturday course. And luckily, we're fully booked sort of 6 months ahead.
And alongside, you have a bakery as well. Now, that's your husband, Emily. Works with bakery, doesn't he?
It is, yes. So we opened a bakery on his farm, which is about 15 minutes drive away, and we opened about 3 years ago, and we had a wood-fired oven, and we just he was a chef before that and then turned his hand to baking, and we just started making small batch sourdough and selling it after COVID to our local villages and delivering it. And in October last year we took the step to open a shop in Woodbridge. We had the commercial kitchen here available and we were struggling to find a tenant. So we thought, right, we're going to go for it. We're going to expand. And we have a team of eight now across the bakery here and the shop.
Do you make it here and you rush it down to the shop?
We do indeed every morning. The van is loaded and it's rushed over to Woodbridge, which is our sort of nearest biggest town, which is a great location.
Come on, Liz. I'll show you.
Oh, smells lovely. We're just going to walk through now to the outdoor kitchen and we're going to join Lucy. This is great, isn't it? Oh, wow. This is a barn, basically, isn't it? This is a barbecue school. I've suddenly realised we've got a lot of wood here and we've got a lot of wood-fired ovens. So, Lucy, when I saw you last, you were doing longhorn beef cattle, which is still here. Just tell me what you're doing now on the farm. And I know you're very self-effacing and I know you do an awful lot of work in the background.
So I mainly work alongside Tom now, which is really exciting. And maybe hopefully looking a little bit more at the detail. So kind of dotting the I's, crossing the T's would be my job. At that point, we were able to purchase a poultry farm off market. And between Dad and I at the time together, we did a huge build project, which Tom then got involved with after his university degree. And that was a real turning point for us. So I managed that farm on a daily basis, the running of the poultry farm.
How big was that?
We were 100,000 ducks at the time. So we were their largest grower. So what a challenge and a project, and we then subsequently built two new sheds as we had planning permission in place to do so. That really took up a huge amount of time whilst running the farm as an entity by itself, which was my main role. But we then got bird flu in 2022, and that was brutal. It was a really awful time, for the family and for that farm. Farms were going down like flies. It was really quite scary, and we had upped to every single measure you could possibly think of to try and not get bird flu. It was a horrible experience. It's not nice for anyone, and the size and the scale of the farm didn't help either, because it was such a big job, even that first step of dealing with the farm. But that farm was then under lock and key by DEFRA for that whole year, so that silver linings, I was then able to have my baby, my first daughter, Margot. So that gave me some time off to look after her whilst we kind of planned for the future.
So a massive disappointment and quite a bit of trauma, I think, looking at your face. It looks like it really did affect you. But actually, the silver lining was that you could then take time off because the poultry farm was closed down and you had your daughter, which was fantastic. What did you learn from all that?
God, what a learning experience that farm was for all of us. Bird flu was one element. The build was another element. And that taught Tom and I a huge amount in terms of construction, lead times, planning for the future, the detail. It was relentless. We were working 18-hour days. We then came back to start harvesting on this farm. We built this kitchen, this outdoor kitchen in between. But so valuable for Tom and I. That's where we really kind of turned a corner, working together and enabling this farm to have a future because of the hard work that went into that farm.
Did you ever feel that the future of this farm was threatened at all, or your three futures threatened at all because of catastrophes like bird flu?
we were in that position where I feel like we had other safety nets before it got so critical. We were very fortunate to be in that place where we had worked hard putting the eggs in other baskets to have that as a fallback. But goodness me, there were times where it was just so touch and go. And I just remember thinking, without each other, how on earth would you get through that? Because it was too much stress for one person to handle.
Goodness me. We'll talk to Tom in just a moment. But I want to just reflect, all of you, Emily, Tom and Lucy, on these downs as well as ups. You know, your dad gave you the opportunity to take on this farm and elements of this farm. You've all had wonderful ideas and taken them forward. Some bits have fallen over flat on their face. Other bits have naturally declined. And as you said, Lucy, you know, you have put eggs in baskets carefully, actually, haven't you?
It's been planned that way. Because we have to, you know, have the risk spread across different areas. For, you know, we've all got to take a livelihood out of this. There's lots of kids. We've got to look after mum and dad. So it has been thought through to the best ability. But there's always things that crop up that you just do not expect.
What would you like to say about this?
The thing that we've been really lucky with is that, like, it's been very easy to think if you're to give your farm to your kids, pride and everything's going well. And I think much more difficult for our dad when things are going badly to not stick an oar in and start trying to change things. But that's how we've been lucky, is that he's let us get on with it and been encouraging but not overbearing. And no problem has ever been as big as you think it is at the time. So they just become really useful learning things. And at least for me, I just feel like each issue that we get past just means that I'm more able to deal with a slightly bigger issue in the future. And that's a important confidence thing, especially at this moment in time where farming is on its face quite badly anyway.
Emily?
I think for me it's about adaptability, and I think that it's having the confidence and kind of the sounding board that when an idea that you've had, for example, the weddings, that something that I've sort of worked really hard at for a very long time, and then you have to really look at the bottom line, you look at the figures, and you think, this is something that we have to really decide on the future of. And so I think having the sounding board of the family to say, actually, you can let that go and put your energy into something else, that's been really helpful for me. And I think, yeah, it's just about adaptability and kind of being able to change your mind and change the way forward.
What we're going to do now is we're going to walk back, but we're going to walk back via Tom's fields. We're just walking on the edge of this arable field, and it's like a jungle. Tom, what are you doing here?
Yeah, so when I came back to this farm was just when the white paper for the Sustainable Farming Centre pilot came out, and so I decided to come back and do that, and they gave us a whole list of things they wanted to do, and we picked this field to do everything that they asked for. So it's got a 24-metre wildlife corridor around the outside. It has beetle banks and pollen mixes alternating every 24 metres. There's a row of walnuts and a row of hazelnuts also alternating.
So, as agroforestry?
That's right,
so you've put in place everything that the Sustainable Farming Incentive pilot into one field,
and then we measure the outcomes of this field versus the monoculture fields and try and work out whether or not there is, like, outside of farming more environmentally, is there like a economic payback as well as an environmental payback. In terms of biodiversity, there's like 35 different varieties of things growing in this field, and then a further lots of species of different bits and bobs. But then also, like, critically, I'm trying to compare the yields between the crops in this field and the crops outside this field.
I know you did your Nuffield scholarship research into hazelnuts.
I remember sitting down and thinking, I need to find a crop that is high value, has a low labour requirement and will yield in a changing climate. And I looked at top fruits, asparagus, soft fruits, etc. But the thing which drew me to nuts is, like, two. One, they're perennial, so they're less affected by annual weather patterns. And secondly, they're non-perishable, so it's entirely mechanised, and also the marketing window is much larger.
What about the soil? I know you're pretty hot on soil health. What sort of land have you got here?
This is quite heavy clay soil. So when I took over the farm, the soils were sampled. And 4 years later, the soils have just been sampled. And we have an increase in potassium, an increase in magnesium, an increase in phosphorus, a reduction in pH, and an increase in soil carbon. And like 4 years is like the blink of an eye for soil. But in every metric, we're going the right way. And we haven't suffered economically for doing that. The way that Dave used to do...
Your dad?
Yeah, sorry. My dad used to have a short crop rotation and a BPS payment, and there is no BPS payment anymore.
That's the basic payment scheme, which subsidy was under the EU.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was no margin in wheat anymore. So we've retained probably a very similar net margin, but it's come from completely different sources. He moved from productivity, and we're trying to go for resilience. So that literally just means producing a crop at the lowest cost per tonne, which inherently involves less fuel, less metal, less working, and then spreading the risk more.
If you look back to 11 years ago, did you think it would work out like this?
No, I didn't actually see a future for myself doing this job whatsoever, but that was really because of the way that the government policy was. Like, all I would have been under the old policy was a glorified groundskeeper of a meticulously kept, short rotation, high input, control the variables, farms. And that's like, it wasn't just reductive in terms of not being able to really make a good income, but it's reductive in terms of how I was actually spending my time and trying to make improvements. And I suppose the other thing is just that the generational difference between me and my dad, like, for him, a good farmer, like, the only thing that's in your field is what you put there. And for my generation, you think that you're going to try and mimic nature, and if you do that successfully, then you'll have a good harvest. And so when the policy changed, it actually changed really in my favour to undertake that work.
That was public money for public goods, exactly. Bringing in environmental practices.
Yeah, and I remember just sitting down with him and him saying, I've done this for 30 years, I don't want to learn from scratch how to do it. And I remember thinking, if I do this now, no one will know any better than me on how to do it. So the timing was perfect.
We've been walking around talking to you as a family that's managed to sort of turn this enterprise into something that supports four families. David, you had the guts to say to your kids, dip a toe in the water, show me what you can do. What do you think of them now?
Ever so pleased, I suppose, how it's turned out for them. It hasn't been easy for them, but they've stuck to it and they've really shown what they're capable of. But Anna, you know, I always quote what would have been a colleague of yours at BBC, and that was about the future. Make no guesses, expect the worst, hope for the best, and above all, maintain a cheerful expression.
David McVeigh quoting Letter from America's Alistair Cook there. On Your Farm was presented and produced in Suffolk with the McVeigh family by Anna Hill. It's a BBC Audio Bristol production. Time now for a weather update. Let's say good morning to Elizabeth Rizzini.
Good morning, Neil. Well, it's all change into next week. We're drawing in a southwesterly wind. The temperatures are set to rise, but until then it stays unsettled. We're dominated by low pressure and there are going to be plenty of showers around. And some of those showers today will be heavy and thundery. So it's a milder, frost-free start to the morning. We've still got Saturday's lingering front across northern Scotland. That's set to clear further northwards, so that rain will gradually lift. It will become more confined to parts of Orkney, actually, as we head through the late morning. Some brighter spells and some showers later. For the rest of Scotland, variable cloud, some brighter skies, but also those heavy, thundery showers. And they're going to be around for much of the rest of the day. For Northern Ireland, too, frequent showers, some heavy and thundery, some gusty winds within the showers, and also the possibility of some hail. But some bright and sunny breaks in between. For Wales and northwest England, again, we're likely to see a good old scattering of heavy thundery showers, particularly as we head through the afternoon. For southern, eastern and central England, however, that early cloud is clearing away. Then we'll see the skies brighten. There will be a lot more cloud developing, but still some spells of hazy sunshine, I think, on and off, and the chance of a few afternoon showers developing here and there, but there'll be much fewer and further between than further north and west. Gentle to moderate westerly to southwesterly winds away from the showers. Top temperatures of 11 to 13 Celsius in the north, 13 to 16 Celsius
further south, and it will feel pleasantly warm in the best of the sunshine. Of course, we've now lost that northerly wind. Tonight for Northern Ireland and for Scotland, it will be turning drier with some clear spells. Another area of rain approaches, and that's going to bring some more rain and showers into Wales, southern Scotland and northern England. For eastern England, dry with some clear spells, maybe some fog patches developing. Frost-free for most, but we could see temperatures dip back to low single figures in Northern Ireland and Scotland.
All right, many thanks, Elizabeth Rizzini. Are some street preachers crossing the line and engaging in intimidating behaviour? We hear about one case from Essex in Sunday at 10 past 7.
Surging AI demand could consume 1.7 trillion gallons of fresh water globally a year by 2027.
Numbers and statistics can be powerful, but what they really mean isn't always clear.
Those figures aren't for water consumption, they're for something different.
So, on More or Less, we unpack those figures that crop up in our lives, peeling back the data to get to the real insights. The new series of More or Less with me, Tim Harford, Wednesday mornings at 9. To listen on your smart speaker, just say play Radio 4.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday the 17th of May. Good morning, this is Charles Carroll. The WHO has said an Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo is a global public health emergency. Police Scotland say they faced unacceptable violence as Celtic fans celebrated their team's premiership title in Glasgow last night. And a Eurovision Song Contest dominated by rows about Israel has ended in a surprise win for Bulgaria. The World Health Organization has declared an Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo to be a public health emergency of international concern. 87 people are now thought to have died, and health experts say this strain of the virus has no vaccine or specific treatment. The WHO said it was not classing this as a pandemic, but it warned of the international spread of the disease. Our correspondent Shingai Nyoka reports from Harare.
The numbers of the dead and sick have been rising rapidly since this outbreak was declared. Just over 330 people are now suspected of having contracted Ebola, mainly in two gold mining border towns, where it's feared that high population movement could spread the disease further. The African Union's Public Health Agency has called for an increase in cross-border monitoring after Uganda confirmed its first fatality. The 59-year-old man had recently travelled from the DRC. Officials have called for international assistance to contain what is now the DRC's 17th outbreak. Initial tests suggest that this is a rare strain of the virus with no vaccine available for it.
The Premiership runners-up, Hearts, say Scottish football has been embarrassed after Celtic fans invaded the pitch in the final minutes of their match yesterday, bringing the game to a sudden end. Police Scotland say they had to deal with unacceptable violence as Celtic supporters gathered in Glasgow to celebrate the team's win. The build-up to the final game had gripped fans, with Hearts hoping to be the first club from outside Glasgow to win the title in more than four decades. Our Scotland correspondent, Katie Hunter, reports.
Police said around 3,000 people made their way to the Trongate area of Glasgow following yesterday afternoon's match between Celtic and Hearts. Dozens of riot police lined up as the celebrations turned to trouble. Police Scotland said missiles, including glass bottles, were thrown at officers and a number were injured. Assistant Chief Constable Mark Sutherland described the level of criminal behaviour as simply unacceptable. Officers are also liaising with Hearts Football Club to establish if any of their players were assaulted following a pitch invasion around full-time. Hearts said it utterly condemned the shameful scenes at Celtic Park yesterday afternoon, which in its words have once again embarrassed Scottish football.
Russia says it's come under a large-scale Ukrainian attack overnight, shooting down more than 500 drones. The mayor of the Moscow region says three people have been killed. Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said on Friday that his country would launch strikes in retaliation for a Russian attack on Kyiv, which killed 24 people. Bulgaria were the surprise winner at last night's Eurovision Song Contest in Austria, which had been overshadowed by a boycott by nations angry about Israel's participation. Ireland and Spain were among the countries refusing to take part because of the war in Gaza. Israel finished second, gaining many of its points from the audience vote. The UK came last with 1 point. Pete Allison sent this report from Vienna.
It's a shock result as Bulgaria hadn't been among the favourites, but build-up to this year's contest focused on Israel's inclusion. Seen by many as controversial due to Israel's military action in Gaza, Iceland, Ireland, the Netherlands, Slovenia and Spain didn't enter as a result. Israel had also denied allegations that it broke Eurovision rules last year, accused of using state-run social media accounts to encourage people to use all 10 of their votes on its song. As for the UK, electronic artist Lukman No Computer's song Eins Zwei Drei stretches the country's winless run to 29 years, with Bulgaria winning the right to host in 2027, one of the most turbulent years in the competition's history, draws to a close.
Labour's opponents say that they will challenge the party's leadership hopefuls on any plans to move the UK closer to the EU. While nobody is yet standing against Sir Keir Starmer, one of the expected contenders, Wes Streeting, said yesterday that he wanted Britain to one day rejoin the EU. The fight within Labour looks set to reignite a Brexit debate, as our political correspondent Damian Grammaticus reports.
Under Sir Keir Starmer, Labour has trodden carefully around the issue of Brexit. But yesterday, Wes Streeting said the party had been too cautious, adding what was needed was a leadership contest with a serious debate about the big choices facing the country. Leaving the EU had been catastrophic, Mr. Streeting added, and said he wanted one day to be back in the European Union. The Conservative chairman, Kevin Hollenrake, said whilst Labour relitigate Brexit, Britain is not being governed. Reform UK said the party would be reminding voters in the Makerfield by-election that Andy Burnham had last year said he hoped in his lifetime to see the UK rejoin the EU, if there was a new mandate to do so. But Mr. Burnham says his priorities are reindustrialisation in the northwest, public control of some important industries that have been privatised, and a huge council house building programme.
The government is exploring whether the north of England could host the Olympic and Paralympic Games. An assessment has been commissioned from UK Sport, which could lead to a bid in the 2040s. The process will look at the chance of success for any application. Any bid would aim to upgrade existing facilities rather than spending big sums on new venues. The Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, says a successful bid would benefit countless lives in the north of England.
I think the north of England, when it comes to sport, is absolutely second to none. And it's our turn. It's our time. We're deadly serious about that. We're putting together this bid in order to bring the Olympics home and share those benefits to every part of the country.
And one of Britain's best-loved sopranos, Dame Felicity Lott, has died at the age of 79. She had announced earlier this month that she had terminal cancer. Dame Felicity made her operatic debut in 1974 and went on to perform at concert halls around the world, singing works by composers including Schubert and Mozart. Here she is at Glyndebourne in 1992, singing the closing scene from Richard Strauss's Capriccio. Felicity Lott was made a dame in 1996 and was also a recipient of the Légion d'Honneur, France's highest cultural award. Announcing her death, her agent said her work was sublime, but that most people were most touched by her humanity and kindness. Well, that's the news this morning. Now a look at the Sunday papers. And the Sunday Telegraph warns that Britain's Brexit wounds could be reopened because it says both Andy Burnham and his leadership rival Wes Streeting favour Britain rejoining the European Union. The paper understands that Reform UK will make Brexit betrayal a theme of its by-election campaign in Makerfield. The Sunday Times says Mr. Streeting's announcement that he wanted to rejoin the EU had electrified the race to succeed Sir Keir Starmer. It says his words signal an end to what it calls the long-standing omerta among senior Labour figures who want to see closer alignment with Brussels. Andy Burnham has spoken to the Sunday Mirror in what it calls his first in-depth interview since he declared his plan to return to Parliament. It says he's laid out his vision for the country and that a Burnham administration would take stronger public control of essentials such as energy and water, introduce proportional representation, and greatly increase the number of council houses built. The Mirror says the need to unify the left is urgent. The Observer describes the Prime Minister attacking Wes Streeting by telling insiders that the Health Secretary damaged the government when he never had a plan to win any leadership ballot. The paper also claims that Sir Keir's relationship with the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, has been gravely damaged by recent events, saying Mr Miliband chose not to urge the party's soft left to support Number 10 when the challenges emerged to the Prime Minister's leadership. Dan Hodges writes in the Mail on Sunday that Sir Keir Starmer has told close friends that he intends to stand down and set out a timetable for his departure. A cabinet minister is quoted in the article as saying he realises the current chaos is unsustainable and will leave in a manner of his own choosing. The Sunday Express claims that Iranian spying operations on UK soil are responsible for the highest number of hostile state activity investigations. A senior counter-terror officer tells the paper that there are record levels of investigative casework on terror plots, espionage, and state-level threats to individuals. And The Sun on Sunday says that armed police protecting the royal family have been accused of falling asleep on the job. The paper says dozens of officers are being investigated, and it says that it's also been claimed that some clocked on, then failed to attend their posts. Sources tell The Sun it's embarrassing. I'll look at the Sunday papers.
Many thanks, Charles Carroll. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 7:10. Time now for Sunday with Julie Etchingham.
Good morning and welcome to Sunday. Coming up, what's behind the sudden rise in abuse of Christians in Jerusalem? A special meeting in the Israeli Knesset in response to a community under attack.
Having one of us a victim of that wasn't a surprise. It's arriving, unfortunately, on a daily basis. But the level of violence was totally unexpected.
Read all about it, why a religious magazine has changed its name because of Nigel Farage and his party, and...
I shook his hand and said, thank you very much for doing this, because I'm pleased that he's doing it. As a Christian, I'm really happy for that.
I don't think this is the place for it, and it does annoy me sometimes that they do it.
As an evangelical church challenges an order to ban its preachers suggesting that passers-by are going to hell, we hear from street preachers about the techniques they use and find out what people think of them. Email us your thoughts to sunday@bbc.co.uk. First this morning, ever since a brutal physical attack on a Catholic nun in Jerusalem at the end of April, there has been mounting concern over a marked rise in anti-Christian abuse in the city. This week, a committee in the Israeli Knesset met to discuss the way Christians are being treated. While physical attacks are rare, verbal insults, vandalism of churches and being spat on has become a daily occurrence for some, and members of the clergy and congregations warn that the abuse is getting worse. Our correspondent Ione Wells reports now from Jerusalem.
The cobbled streets of Jerusalem's old city form one of the holiest sites for three major religions, Islam, Christianity, Judaism. Tensions between different religions are certainly nothing new. But Christians here have been saying that in recent years, particularly since the war in Gaza, they have been facing more incidents of day-to-day harassment, things like spitting, graffiti, even in some cases, physical and verbal attacks. The Christian community here in Jerusalem was shocked recently when a video went viral of a man pushing a French Catholic nun to the ground and kicking her in the old city. It took place on Mount Zion, near a site Jews believe is King David's tomb and Christians believe is the site of the Last Supper. The suspect is a 36-year-old Israeli settler called Yona Simcha Schreiber from a settlement in the occupied West Bank. The nun was a researcher here at the French School of Biblical and Archaeological Research in Jerusalem. It's a very peaceful spot, full of courtyards surrounded by pines and birdsong. It's got one of the largest churches here in Jerusalem, a peaceful contrast to some of the harassment, comments, abuse that some of the Christians here face when they go into the old city. Its director, Father Olivier Poquillon, says the attack was a shock, but not a surprise.
Having one of us a victim of that wasn't a surprise. It's arriving, unfortunately, on a daily basis. But the level of violence was totally unexpected. And this is showing, this is a new step in what we are facing. Physically speaking, she was very lucky, but psychologically speaking, she's still under shock, and now she has to refrain from walking in the old city.
Over the past month, anti-Christian incidents have also occurred in the West Bank and southern Lebanon, where an Israeli soldier was photographed smashing up a crucifix and another holding a cigarette to a statue of the Virgin Mary. The soldiers involved in these incidents were given military detention. This week, Jerusalem church leaders urged Israel to address rising hate crimes against Christians at a committee in Israel's parliament, the Knesset.
Not Israel.
Gilad Kariv, chair of the Israeli Immigration, Absorption and Diaspora Committee, called the attack on a nun terrorism.
There are about 200,000 Christian citizens in the state of Israel. Christian families are afraid to come to the old city of Jerusalem. This is a situation we must not accept.
An Israeli police commander in the old city said his force was doing everything possible to allow people of all faiths to go about their lives. The hearing happened the day before Jerusalem Day, when Israel celebrates its capture and annexation of East Jerusalem in 1967. Here, crowds of mostly religious nationalist youth waving Israeli flags parade through this predominantly Palestinian area and the Muslim quarter of the old city. At times, they sang insults at Arabs and attacked and vandalised shops. Most of the harassment was directed at Palestinians in the Muslim quarter, but the Christian areas were targeted too.
Now, there was this group here of Ethiopian Jewish girls who learned from us. It was interesting because they were open, curiously, to what we had to say. They heard, they learned about the Armenians, about the Armenian genocide, and then the smaller girl said, are they Christians? So they should die.
The Religious Freedom Data Center, who run a hotline for anti-Christian harassment, set up an educational stall in the Armenian Christian quarter of the old city. Its founder, Yiska Harani, said in 2025 their hotline received 181 reports of anti-Christian harassment, but that this is likely an underestimate.
This is something that we are monitoring because we see it, but many times we're not here. Then, secondly, some Christians think that if they will file a complaint, their visas may be taken. I don't think this is true, but it shows you the vulnerability.
Yiska says often some of the anti-Christian attitudes among some extremist Jewish communities comes from the bloody history between Jews and Christians.
There are three roads to making this change. You have to understand that history does not die out, but there's present. We live in the 21st century. Secondly, enforcement. If the police doesn't take it seriously. And it's not really the police, it's the government. And the third thing is the visibility of Christians in the public space. So this is the responsibility of the mayor of Jerusalem. If you make this like a cultural cleansing, then of course somebody will come and say, so why did you penetrate my territory?
Back at the school of the nun who was attacked in Jerusalem, her colleagues are closely watching the outcome of the suspect's upcoming trial. Father Olivier hopes justice will be served to set an example.
The political climate is not helping, since there may be a feeling of impunity from perpetrators of crimes. So we are really monitoring the enforcement of the laws, and we will see the outcome of the judiciary process.
Father Olivier Poquillon ending that report from Ione Wells in Jerusalem. Now, try as you might, there is no getting away from it. The build-up to that by-election in Makerfield, which could eventually see the Greater Manchester Mayor on his way to Downing Street, is likely to be the only political story in town in the coming weeks. There will be an almighty political battle, of course, with Reform UK pledging to throw everything at the race and stop Andy Burnham's ambitions to be Prime Minister. But already there are countless articles assessing what sort of PM Burnham might make, should he get there. Well, an interview we did in December after Andy Burnham had given the annual Theos lecture might give us a bit of a handle.
When you visit the Vatican, as I did with my mum in 2023, I can't deny the magnetic pull that I felt right inside me.
So if you were Prime Minister, would you do God? There were two questions in there.
I don't think that's a likelihood, given where we are, but I've never shied away from it. It's part of my makeup, the fact that I had that upbringing.
And would you say now on record that you do believe in God and do you pray?
I'll be honest, no, I don't. I said before that I considered myself agnostic.
Treading quite a careful line there, I think, Andy Burnham speaking to us in December. And it's worth noting that the now self-declared potential other contender is Wes Streeting, and he's spoken openly about his Anglican Christian faith. Angela Rayner, should she join a race, has described herself as not being religious. So after that long spell where politicians kept God firmly out of politics, where is religion's place now? Well, I'm joined by Andrew Brown, columnist for the Church Times, who's written about faith and politics. Morning to you, Andrew. What did you make of what Andy Burnham had to say there?
I thought it was very cautious, but a recognition of the way that religion can no longer be shoved to the sidelines as it was during the Blair years. If you remember, there's a famous G.K. Chesterton quote to the effect that when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in anything. And you might flip that to look at today and say, when people don't believe in anything, they're capable of believing in God again.
It is remarkable and notable that politicians are much more comfortable with speaking about it, though. Why is that, do you think?
I think partly because politicians are not so much distrusted today, but they seem powerless even to themselves. Whereas religious leaders can offer to deliver votes and to some extent social change. And this is a temptation both to politicians and to the religious, and we shouldn't expect either of them to resist it.
And do you think it's to be welcomed, the fact that there's the nature of the conversation has changed around it, or are there pitfalls there?
I think there are certainly pitfalls, but we welcome it because it has to happen. If you think of politics simply as satisfying what people want as consumers, you very rapidly end up in a dead end, both because not everybody can have it, and because the people who get it are not satisfied. So religion offers all the things that markets don't. It offers identities, but of course identities clash, and then we have problems, as we've seen on the streets of London yesterday.
Well, indeed, and that's what I was about to ask you, that the flip side of it, of course, is that religion becomes as polarising, potentially, as political divisions.
I would say it was even more polarising than political divisions, because it deals with identities. But that's the way human beings are. I don't think we can sit in our comfortable studio and say, oh, well, you shouldn't be like that. People are.
Is Andy Burnham onto something? It was interesting, the wider sort of conversation that he was hoping to start in that lecture, was in understanding how churches, mosques, places of worship are interconnected very deeply at community level. And if he is aiming to foster a grassroots-up politics, is he onto something, do you think?
Oh, yes, I think that's one of the things that politicians now miss. Political parties don't offer that sort of engagement, and religions offer a bridge between the way you live your daily life and the way you would like society to be, which is something which perhaps political parties once did, but they don't do anymore.
And the spectacle of the country's first altar boy to make it to Downing Street, if he manages to clear. I mean, there are significant hurdles ahead, of course, there are a lot of those to come. It might be quite a moment for the country.
Oh, yes. And burial, of course, of the country's historic and anti-Catholicism. I mean, for many centuries, Britain was defined as a country that was not Roman Catholic. And to have an altar boy in Downing Street would be extraordinary.
Andrew Brown, columnist for the Church Times. Great to speak to you this morning. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Well, as we've just been hearing, few would doubt in the broader political landscape the huge impact that Reform UK has had on Britain's political landscape, not least in the wake of the recent elections. But its influence has been felt too, in a place you might not have expected, on the name of a religious magazine published by the United Reformed Church. This week, after polling its readers, it's changed the name of the publication from Reform to Reformed. There had been complaints that it was being confused with Nigel Farage's party. Well, I'm joined now by the editor of the newly named Reformed magazine, Stephen Tompkins. A very good morning to you, Mr. Tompkins. Now, the magazine's been around for more than 50 years. Why did you feel you had to make the decision?
People have been asking us for a few years now if we were going to change the name of the magazine once Reform UK, the party, started rising to greater prominence. And at first, I suppose we took the point of view it was our name first. We've been around for more than 50 years. And the magazine's tied up with the life of the church. We weren't in any hurry to change the name, and we were prepared just to seek it out. But just recently, we had been hearing that the name was properly causing difficulties in local churches. So churches were telling us that they were putting posters on the wall promoting Reform magazine, and then having to answer questions from people using the church, wondering if the church was affiliated with a political party. People were telling us, so one reader from Surrey told me that much as he loved the magazine, of course, every time someone came round, he had to turn the magazine face down so that he didn't have to answer questions about why he was subscribing to the magazine.
But presumably you'll have church members who would be supporters of Nigel Farage's party, potentially. I mean, it's not a magazine with a great sort of political push in it, is it?
We have a whip, and our contributors and our readers are certainly engaged in politics, but it's not a political magazine. And there's, of course, room in the United Reformed Church for people from all political perspectives, and we have contributors from all political perspectives. But once the magazine is getting confused in people's minds as being affiliated with a particular party, then that's causing problems for people. And they were telling us it was causing problems. And enough people felt that there was confusion there, that it was, you know, reluctantly, we had to burn into the confusion.
I suppose it's worth noting that the name change is not a sort of huge radical move, is it? It's a small one. Does it go far enough, do you think? There may still be room for confusion, given that you've just added an ED to it.
Yes, and when we saw the name, we're still at the stage of having to articulate the difference that it's performed. But what people were telling us is that it was people seeing the name of the magazine that was really causing the problems. And posters, when people came around to fix it, Willer and started, saw the magazine and got into a conversation about immigration policy. And so what we've done is to make a change in the name, which is enough that it's clear that people are not going to look at the magazine and get confused about what it is. But because the magazine has had such a long part in the history of the United Reformed Church, we're also keen to let people know that it's still the same magazine. We don't want any confusion from the other side, and people are wondering whether this is the same magazine or not. And so it looks the same, it's got a very similar name, but it's still the same magazine, has the same role in the life of the church. But hopefully it's a bit less confusion about
Okay, Stephen Tompkins, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning, and apologies for the sound quality, but I hope you heard everything that Stephen had to say. Now, who helped and who didn't still echoes as one of history's most searing questions in the wake of the Holocaust. As well as the countries who fought against the Nazis in the war, the light has often been shone on heroic individuals who risked their own lives to save Jews. Denmark, too, was the only country occupied by the Nazis which maintained a national policy to help Jews escape. But have there been lessons missed in understanding which local communities and specifically religious groups refused to look the other way and which ones did? This is the subject of the annual Alfred Wiener Holocaust Memorial Lecture tomorrow by Professor Mary Fulbrook, who was brought up as a Quaker. She told me why she wanted to revisit this age-old question through the lens of communities across Europe.
I wanted to get away from national generalisations, good and bad, and I also wanted to get away from the focus on individual rescuers as exceptional heroes, and I wanted to understand what it was about the wider community that facilitated the rescue of fugitives from persecution, or in some way fostered a sense of compassion, a feeling for fellow human beings. And it's not just faith communities, I should say. It's people of no religion as well. The sense of community is what is important, and the sense that the persecuted are fellow human beings whose lives are worth saving.
Different religious faiths then are not necessarily a guide to who helped and who didn't.
Absolutely not. I mean, that's precisely one of the points that I'm exploring, because there are very few faiths that seem almost uniformly to have been on the side of the persecuted, to have tried to help. I think the Quakers are quite remarkable in that respect, because wherever you look, you find people being helped. But whichever other religious group you look at, you find huge variations. The Christian Church has had centuries of anti-Semitism to answer for in many places.
Well, there was, of course, that sort of notorious tension between the institution of the Roman Catholic Church, which maintained a public silence during the Holocaust at an institutional level, but then there were priests, bishops, religious sisters who were helping in very vivid ways.
Exactly. I mean, this is the interesting thing. Why is it that while the Pope kept quiet and many, many members of the Catholic Church were anti-Semitic and unhelpful in the extreme, there were individuals who really did either stand up publicly, which was mighty risky, or help people privately in one way or another? And we should remember the Catholic Church, and indeed the Christian churches generally, including Protestants here, are very, very variable.
What were some of those variations? Because you studied some very specific examples, didn't you?
I've been exploring in depth what I call islands of compassion in a wider sea of hostility, because there are some remarkable areas in Europe, and I'm concentrating in my lecture on five in particular, where more people were willing to help. And if you look at these places, Le Chambon-sur-Lignon in southern France, for example, many people point to the Huguenot tradition there. Persecuted Protestants had sympathy with other victims of persecution. But in fact, it goes across the confessions. There's a Derbyist sect, there are Catholics there, there are secular people there. But there was something about the wider community culture in Le Chambon which fostered both compassion or willingness to maintain silence and not denounce others in Greece. What we find in Volos is the bishop and the rabbi urging their respective flocks to flee or to provide assistance to the people who are fleeing. Most importantly here, the local communist partisan group helping to get the Jews out of Volos and up into the hills and forcibly persuading local peasants to take in fugitives. So I think we're not talking about compassion necessarily as forcible persuasion, if I can put it that way. And you see that in a number of other places too.
What lessons might there be from what you've learned, not least against this backdrop of this rise in anti-Semitism that we're witnessing in Britain and more widely?
I think the lessons go from the institutional level right down to the individual level.
And do you think the institutions, the other faith institutions alongside Judaism, are speaking up clearly enough now?
It's so hard, isn't it, to understand how we could deal with the situation. You know, if we're not trying to solve world problems, if we're looking purely at anti-Semitism in Britain today, I think it is really important to note that the government is taking a very strong stand against anti-Semitism. That is quite the opposite from state-sponsored anti-Semitism during the Nazi period. And secondly, I think we have to foster mutual understanding, which is difficult, and it does mean forming alliances of support, and I don't have simple answers there, I'm afraid, and I wish I did.
But that notion of human connection is presumably one which every single human being can act on in a modern context.
That is right. And I think what is interesting in the Nazi period is the significance of the Quaker phrase, see that of God in everyone, rather than seeing people of other faiths, other ethnicities, as your enemy, your competitor, someone towards whom you may not be hostile, but you're indifferent. Indifference is such a key aspect of bystander passivity during the Holocaust. Indifference and just simply not caring, and then willingness to benefit from the absence of Jews.
Professor Mary Fulbrook speaking to me earlier. It's just coming up to 8:25. Still to come on the programme, a love letter wrapped in pain, a mother's memoir of her son who was killed after he was taken hostage on October the 7th. First, there are few scandals which have hit a faith institution harder than the serial abuser John Smythe hit the Church of England. It led not just to outrage over his crimes and the institutional failures in the church to stop him, but also, of course, the resignation of the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. A Channel 4 documentary called See No Evil, charting the uncovering of the scandal, was recognised with a BAFTA this week. On the production team was author Andrew Greystone, whose dogged pursuit of the truth about Smythe helped to bring the story to light. This is what he had to say on BAFTA night.
I have spent the last 10 years listening to people who have been harmed in the life of the church, and it's a harrowing business. And I want to pay tribute to Passion Pictures for the way that they have listened and cared and loved the people who have opened their souls in this film, and I want to say to the Church of England, watch and learn. Watch and learn what healing can come from deep listening. Thank you.
Well, just a day after the BAFTAs, Andrew Greystone found himself in a courtroom as another huge figure in the evangelical movement, former vicar Jonathan Fletcher, was judged to have indecently assaulted a man over a 20-year period. Andrew spoke to me earlier about the Church of England's response to Jonathan Fletcher and other abusers and his role in supporting victims.
Jonathan Fletcher was a very prominent figure, an international preacher and teacher and really a kingmaker in conservative evangelical circles. He attended the UN camps that John Smythe was involved with, and he would use them to recruit young men as future leaders in the conservative evangelical network. Jonathan Fletcher would take his favourite men into his home to live with him as his disciples, and they would have intensive mentoring. And essentially, if you had Jonathan Fletcher's approval, you'd find yourself in plum jobs in the Church of England. It's been said that if conservative evangelicalism had a pope, it would be Jonathan Fletcher. All last week, Jonathan Fletcher was on trial in Kingston Crown Court, but because he's now 83 and suffering from dementia, he was ruled unfit to plead. So what took place was what's known as a trial of the facts. And the jury was asked to determine whether he had committed the abuse of which he was accused. And the jury decided that he'd committed at least 16 acts of indecent assault on a much younger man over a period of about 25 years.
And when did the allegations against him first surface, Andrew?
Well, they didn't really come to light until 2017. And at that point, the Church of England removed his permission to minister. And the church instigated its own independent inquiry. And the independent inquiry identified not one, but 27 men who saw themselves as victims of Jonathan Fletcher. But such is his continuing hold over these people that only one man had the courage to take his complaint to the police.
And you've been instrumental in supporting the man that went to the police. How has he navigated this process?
This is a person who has been damaged throughout his life. He's a man who's now 70, but his life has been dominated by Jonathan Fletcher. There's a kind of relief at getting to the end of the trial and an element of vindication in that the jury has found that these things actually happened. But of course, there's no real justice because there is no disposal available to the court for somebody who has dementia like Fletcher. So he goes away with a complete discharge, even though he was found to have done these things. It's very unsatisfactory, really, as is the end of the John Smythe case.
I suppose there is one aspect of this case which the church would want to point to, and that might be that it did respond with having an independent body assess this case. Is that a flicker of progress on that front, do you think?
Well, actually, the Church of England hasn't had any inquiry. It was the local church of which Jonathan Fletcher was a minister. And the church's failure to learn from these events is perhaps the most shocking thing about it.
The C of E, of course, has said that it's now investigating millions in national safeguarding work. There is, of course, still that question mark about the establishment or otherwise of a fully independent body to look at these cases. It will talk, too, about allocating millions towards the costs of redress. There will be some who will say the church is getting to grips with this issue. What would you say to that?
Well, the Church of England is using quite a sophisticated distraction technique when it comes to safeguarding. It's saying, look at all the money we're spending on preventative safeguarding. Look at the committees, look at this board, this redress scheme, this training program. But time and again, it fails to address the healing and repair of the individuals who've been harmed. When it comes to it, abuse of this kind or of any kind is about the abuse of power. And the hard questions about why this is happening are actually very challenging to the power structures of not only the conservative evangelical part of the church, but the rest of the church too. And the only way I can see change coming is through a real deep listening, senior church leaders spending extended time with people who've been harmed and asking, what's happened to you? What have we done to you? And how can we begin to put it right? If church leaders could listen to survivors in that way, then there is some hope that there might be healing for them.
That is exactly what, of course, the new Archbishop of Canterbury has pledged. Do you believe her?
She's pledged to take safeguarding very seriously. But what she seems to mean by that is more preventative work. And the preventative safeguarding work of the Church of England is really pretty good for an organisation of its size and complexity. But until you ask, why is our church so prone to abuse? Horrible, power-hungry men like Jonathan Fletcher and John Smythe will continue to abuse their power and cause lifelong harm to people who only want to live out their faith.
Andrew Greystone there, speaking to me earlier. An evangelical church in Essex has launched an appeal against an order preventing intimidating behaviour by its members preaching on the street. The Bread of Life Community Church in Colchester allegedly told passers-by they were going to hell. Colchester City Council has applied to police to issue a community protection notice. The church maintains it's preaching a message of God's love. The case, of course, raises a lot of questions, not least about the lines preachers may or may not cross legally. What is public opinion on street preachers, and has that changed? Our reporter Naomi Wellings has been to the heart of London's shopping district, where street preaching is part of the daily bustle.
Good afternoon, people of Oxford Street. People may cry out to God and say, why is there so much suffering in this world? Why is there so much pain?
And Dave Mwaniki and his team from Open Air Campaigners Ministries are by the entrance to the Tube, somewhere they've been for four decades each and every week.
Not everyone will agree with us. You know, we spoke to many atheists and people from, you know, different faiths, but we're able to share what we believe who Jesus is and the change that he's done in my life and how he can bring peace even through the stormy, difficult times.
So you're working with yellow and blue at the moment.
More other colours on in a minute.
They illustrate their messages on a board and, unlike some other speakers, don't use any amplification. Yet, as relatively low-key as they are, there are mixed views on whether this kind of activity has a place in public.
I don't think it's appropriate. Let the people do what they want to do. Give them the freedom to choose, you know.
I don't believe in God, but I believe space and time to do it in a church.
I don't really mind what people do on the street. They can do what they want, yeah.
I shook his hand and said, thank you very much for doing this, because I'm pleased that he's doing it. As a Christian, I'm really happy for that.
I don't think this is the place for it, and it does annoy me sometimes that they do it. Twice, different faiths have said to me that if I didn't believe in God, that I'm going to go straight to hell. And then I said, okay, I've just lost my parents, and they didn't believe in God, but they were the nicest people that you could meet. And they said, oh, well, I'm sorry that they've gone to hell because they didn't believe in God. And I thought, if that's where religion is taking you and you're spouting that on the street, that's what I think is dangerous.
But how does the Lord judge what's inappropriate or offensive? Sam Webster, a solicitor based at the Christian Institute, has been advising street evangelists for more than two decades.
Now, we do have public order legislation that addresses the question of threatening, abusive or insulting words or behaviour. But at the end of the day, it is a defence if the street preacher can show that his conduct was reasonable in all the circumstances.
His organisation wrote a street preacher's charter last year to help guide preachers about both their rights and their responsibilities.
Where cases have arisen, well, firstly with police forces, there can be a misconstruing of what public order legislation says. So the mere fact somebody has complained to the police and has said that they're offended by something that's been said, the officer jumps to the conclusion that that must mean that Section 5 or Section 4A of the Public Order Act are engaged in some way. But invariably, later it's found, you know, the street preacher has not broken the law.
I did a little Facebook post about it and I was so shocked. It went right round the world. So
Pastor Mick Fleming from Burnley, his ministry on the streets, sees him drive around in a van which spells out his message.
So on the back of my van is John 3:16, which says, for God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten son, whoever believes in him will have eternal life. So it's like a gospel message. And I was stopped by a policeman and he sort of said to me, you know, if somebody complained about that, so in the wrong context, you know, that could be seen as hate speech. And I said, but it says loved. I said, so what can be so hateful about that? And he said, I'm just saying, if someone complained, we'd have to come and speak to you about it. So I think there's a real big questions that are being asked about free speech and what that means and how we come to understand that.
Lancashire Police has no record of this and says it wouldn't view it as a hate crime. There are a variety of ways street ministry is active across the UK. I spoke to Dr. Rachel Jordan-Wolfe from Hope Together, an organisation which trains evangelists and reports a resurgence of interest amongst young passers-by.
The culture's moved. We have this hungry generation. They've not seen people with a Bible table. To them, it's not negative. It's a new thing, and it's an authentic way for us to share our faith with a generation.
Hey guys, what do you want?
Okay, you got
three
one.
Hot chocolates.
Three hot chocolates.
Yeah. Okay.
Stephen McArdle and his team from the Ixus movement are giving out hot drinks to students outside Greenwich University in southeast London. They rarely preach now, preferring the one-to-one approach.
Well, Lord Jesus, thank you so much for these three guys. Lord, thank you that we bumped into them today. And I just pray that they'll be so blessed today, Lord, that your love...
The rain may be beating on the umbrellas, but there's a steady flow of people still stopping to chat and be prayed for.
Some hot woman that we get this kind of like treat after. Putting the hard work into it.
Pastor Mick Fleming, the street evangelist with the Bible text on his van, says, like Ixus, he doesn't really preach on the streets anymore, working in an area where there's high levels of poverty, addiction and homelessness. The gospel he ministers on the streets is a practical one. And he says it's helped many people come to faith.
Lift them up, feed them, love them and care for them, then they'll hear the message that you've got, because they will have already heard it in your actions. So if somebody's going to stand up and preach a good one and tell me about John 3:16, so God so loved the world, and you're not going to show me the love that's in you that can go out and do that, I don't want to listen to you. I think you're a liar. You have to ask yourself, why are you going into that space? And if it's, well, I'm doing it for God, well, what's that? You know, why are you not cooking chips for God then?
Pastor Mick Fleming ending that report from Naomi Wellings. And we've had some emails from you about street preachers. Colette has been in touch and says it's true that there are some street preachers who rant at passers-by, but there are a large number who sincerely wish to engage with people in a sensible way. And Katrina too has been in touch. Thank you, Katrina. She says that in London, walking to the tube station, she passes a succession of preachers shouting at her. Often they have speakers and microphones. She says they should stop bellowing at everyone. Let us know what you think. You don't need to bellow at sunday@bbc.co.uk. Now, Israel said this weekend it had killed Izz al-Din al-Haddad, one of the last surviving senior Hamas commanders in Gaza, involved in planning the October 7th attacks. It comes shortly after the publication of a powerful memoir by an American Israeli mother whose son was murdered in the wake of the onslaught that day. Hirsch Goldberg Polin was abducted by Hamas from the Nova Music Festival, held hostage for 328 days, and then murdered as a captive. His mother, Rachel, describes the memoir as a love letter wrapped in pain. She's called it When We See You Again, and Rachel Goldberg Polin joins us now. A very good morning to you, Rachel. The pain of this book is so raw on every page. You called writing it the rape of your soul. Why did you decide to put pen to paper?
Well, really, my soul was actually buckling and choking from the weight of this suffering and pain. I was actually drowning. So it felt like I was almost performing the Heimlich maneuver on myself through words. I was excising this severe angst and misery, which, you know, I am not unique. There are millions of people in the world who have buried children. There are millions of people in the world who have buried people who are core and intrinsic to the DNA of how we identify ourselves in this world. So the reaction that I have gotten is so fascinating because we've had thousands and thousands and thousands of messages of people saying, you said it. You said it. You know, it was like, this is something that so many people experience, this wanting to not have incurable muteness about having suffered a tremendous blow.
Was you write about your son in such vivid detail. Was there any comfort in that level of detail, simply putting it out there and sort of giving him to the reader in that way?
I wonder. When I was doing it, I was really doing it as, here are packages of pain. As you said, you know, I think it became this love story swaddled in pain, or perhaps a pain story that was doused in love. And I think that I had one woman write to me, I love that now I would recognize Hirsch from behind because you've described him so specifically. And, you know, I don't think of this book. I know a lot of people are saying it's a memoir. I don't think of it as a memoir or a tell-all or a he did that and she did this or I was down here and now look, I've transcended and I have resilience and now I'm up here. No, no, no. I wish. But it's not what it is. I do think that there is something fascinating that people feel that they understand Hirsch more, because I didn't realize I was doing that. I really didn't know.
I mean, you've spoken very vividly, not least just a moment ago, about the utterly disordered nature of losing a child. You've acknowledged, of course, in previous interviews that you've given, that this happened on both sides of the border with Gaza. Do you feel a connection with those mothers who've lost their own children in these appalling circumstances?
I absolutely do. And I think that it's such a terrible error for all of us to think in terms of an adversarial paradigm of you have to choose one side or the other. We human beings are imbued with godliness and we have wisdom and insight and we can hold multiple truths. And I can feel throughout, I have said, I feel worried, concerned, and terrified for the innocent civilians in Gaza, and I feel worried, concerned, and terrified for the innocent civilians in Gaza who were dragged there on October 7th. I feel sadly united to anyone in not just this region, but in our world right now, in all of these multiple conflicts that we have, who have had to bury children, spouses, brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, grandparents, grandchildren. I feel absolutely that there is a tragic bond of unity in this pain and suffering. This is part of the human condition.
And
we will all experience loss.
And just in brief, if I may, Rachel, how did that your faith persist through this horror?
I say multiple times a day, thank God I believe in God, thank God I believe in God, thank God I believe in God. To me, it's very clear that there is a plan. I don't have to like the plan. I hate that Hirsch isn't here. I hate it. But I really, truly know that I am just a teeny tiny part of a huge, magnificent tapestry. And I'm only privy to a teeny tiny part, so I don't understand it. And I probably never will.
Rachel Goldberg-Perlin, thank you very much indeed for sharing your story with us this morning. That is it for this week's Sunday. William Crawley's here next week. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Sunday was produced by Katie Booth and Alexa Good. Now the comedian Ashley Story makes this week's Radio 4 appeal on behalf of Hope Support Services.
A warm-up game at a session run by Hope Support Services. The group has been tasked with crossing the room without walking. It's fun figuring out what to do. Lots of rolling around is involved. Lots of laughter too. But there is a serious side to this group. All the young people here have a loved one who is seriously ill. These games help them let off steam and start talking. And once they talk, that's when they can offer each other the peer-to-peer support they all desperately need. Each year, Hope Support Services helps around 400 children and young people from across the UK through groups like this one in Hereford, or through family days or one-to-one support sessions or residential trips. It's helped Liberty. She was 15 when her older sister India was diagnosed with a brain tumour. It was, she says, an incredibly lonely experience for her. Her parents were busy rushing India to hospital appointments, and none of her friends were going through anything similar. She had no one to confide in. But then her family learnt of Hope Youth Sessions at the hospice where India was receiving treatment. Meeting other young people helped Liberty express what she was feeling about her sister's illness without judgment. She made new friends who understood, who she was able to confide in, friends who were there to offer her love when India sadly died and Liberty tried to come to terms with her grief. Hope's support did not end there. After India's death, Liberty joined other Hope young people who had lost loved ones on a trip to Tanzania. It was a transformative experience. With the other young people, she witnessed the birth of a child for the first time. And now, age 26, Liberty works as a midwife. Losing someone you love at any age can be lonely and scary. Hope helps children and young people to cope better when they're suffering unbearable loss. A group session, like the one we heard, costs about £100 to run, and a trust which supports Hope Support Services will match donations to a total of £5,000. Help more young people get the support they need by giving now. Just search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal, or call 0800 404 8144. That's 0800 404 8144. Or you can write a cheque to Hope Support Services and send it to Free Post, BBC Radio 4 Appeal. And importantly, please mark the back of your envelope, Hope Support Services. Thank you.
Ashley Story, the number to call again, 0800 404 8144. The calls are free from landlines and also from mobiles. And you can find all the details for giving online if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. Remember, if you are a UK taxpayer and if you want Hope Support Services to collect the gift aid on your donation, please include an email or postal address so they can send you a gift aid declaration. Let's get the weather update now. Here's Elizabeth Rizzini.
Oh, Neil, thank you. For today, it's a really mixed start to the morning, actually. It's frost-free. We've still got some rain across northern Scotland. That's going to push northwards, and it will become more confined to the Northern Isles later. Some brighter skies eventually developing, but also some showers. And for the rest of Scotland and for Northern Ireland, there will be variable amounts of cloud, some brighter spells, but also some heavy, thundery showers on and off throughout the day. There could be some gusty winds and some hail involved too. Some bright and sunny breaks, of course, in between the showers as well. For Wales and for northwest England, expect a good scattering of showers, especially through the afternoon. Again, there could be some thunder and some lightning, but some sunshine in between the showers. And of course, it won't be raining all the time. For southern, eastern and central parts of England, then we're looking at early cloud and rain clearing eastwards. It will brighten up quite nicely. And then it turns cloudier again with some bright, some hazy spells of sunshine. Sunshine on and off, largely dry further west too. The chance of one or two afternoon showers developing, particularly towards southern counties of England, and a gentle to moderate westerly to southwesterly wind away from those showers. So some of the showers could last for some time. Temperatures on a par with yesterday's, still below the seasonal average, 11 to 13 Celsius in the north, 13 to 16 Celsius further south. It will be turning warmer into next week, but still some more wet weather to get through, including overnight tonight. But for Northern Ireland and Scotland, it will be turning drier with some clear spells, a chance of a touch of frost here. Another area of rain approaches from the southwest. Eastern England, largely dry too.
All right, many thanks, Elizabeth Rizzini. Sunday worship comes to us from the home of the BBC National Chorus of Wales. That's in 10 minutes. And in an hour, it's Broadcasting House with Paddy O'Connell. Good morning, Paddy.
Neil, how does it keep going, this programme? I never really know. But it's lovely to see you.
To see you, nice.
Good morning to you as well, at home. Well, Andy Burnham's on the stump, Wes Streeting's on the podium. Labour has caught the Conservative bug for toppling Prime Ministers. One of the people who knows about this is Kemi Badenoch. She's our guest, who has seen both areas of chaos from rival benches. Locals teach us a lesson about the newsmaker Makerfield constituency. George Formby grew up nearby. We learn the names of British butterflies. Do you know your brimstone from your peacock?
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday, the 17th of May. Good morning, this is Charles Carroll. The World Health Organization has warned of the possible international spread of Ebola, which has killed dozens of people in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Police in Glasgow have been pelted with bottles after thousands of Celtic fans gathered to celebrate the Premiership title. And Bulgaria have won the Eurovision Song Contest for the first time, beating Israel into second place. The World Health Organization has declared an Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo to be a public health emergency of international concern. 87 people are now thought to have died, and health experts say this strain of the virus has no vaccine or specific treatment. The WHO said it was not classing this as a pandemic, but it warned of the international spread of the disease. Our Africa correspondent, Thomas Mkwana, reports from Nairobi.
The UN Health Agency declared this outbreak of Ebola as public health emergency of international concern following confirmation of the first death of the deadly virus outside of DR Congo. Yesterday, it emerged a patient who died in Uganda had tested positive. WHO warns that although the outbreak doesn't constitute a pandemic yet, there is a high risk of cross-border spread due to population mobility and travel links between countries in the region. Most of the deaths suspected to have been from Ebola have been reported in three health zones in the eastern Congolese province of Ituri. One case of the virus has been reported in the capital, Kinshasa, in a patient returning from Ituri. There are no approved vaccines and treatment for the Budimbujo strain of Ebola detected in the current outbreak.
Russia says it's come under a large-scale Ukrainian attack overnight and that it shot down more than 500 drones. The mayor of the Moscow region says that three people have been killed. Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, said on Friday that his country would launch strikes in retaliation for a Russian attack on Kyiv, which killed 24 people. Police Scotland say they had to deal with unacceptable violence as fans gathered in Glasgow to celebrate Celtic's Premiership win. Hearts, who were beaten by Celtic in the final match of the season, say they're working with police to investigate if any of their players or staff were assaulted when a pitch invasion brought the game to a sudden end. Our Scotland correspondent Katie Hunter reports.
Police said around 3,000 people made their way to the Trongate area of Glasgow following yesterday afternoon's match between Celtic and Hearts. Dozens of riot police lined up as the celebrations turned to trouble. Police Scotland said missiles, including glass bottles, were thrown at officers and a number were injured. Officers are also liaising with Hearts Football Club to establish if any of their players were assaulted following a pitch invasion around full-time. Hearts said it utterly condemned the shameful scenes at Celtic Park yesterday afternoon, which in its words have once again embarrassed Scottish football.
The Conservatives have accused Labour of trying to relitigate Brexit after one of the party's leadership contenders, Wes Streeting, said he hoped the UK would one day rejoin the EU. He said Brexit had been a catastrophic mistake. Reform UK says that it will ensure that voters in the Makerfield constituency are reminded that Andy Burnham, another likely Labour leadership candidate, has also said in the past that he hopes Britain will rejoin. The government says the Chancellor will call for coordinated international action to limit inflation when she travels to Paris this week for a G7 finance ministers meeting. Rachel Reeves is also expected to announce a package of support for households and businesses in the UK struggling with energy bills and the impact of the war in Iran. Here's our business reporter, Ben King.
So far, the energy price cap for Great Britain has protected domestic energy consumers from the impact of the war in Iran. But from July, bills are expected to rise, reflecting the higher cost of gas on global markets. The cap is projected to increase by nearly 13% to around £1,850 a year for gas and electricity for a typical household. Rachel Reeves has promised to set out plans to support families and businesses this week. It's expected to involve targeted help for lower-income households and businesses which use large amounts of energy.
Bulgaria was the surprise winner at last night's Eurovision Song Contest in Austria, which had been overshadowed by a boycott by nations angry about Israel's participation. Ireland and Spain were among the countries refusing to take part because of the war in Gaza. Israel finished second, gaining many of its points from the audience vote. The UK came last with 1 point. Pete Allison sent this report from Vienna.
It's a shock result as Bulgaria hadn't been among the favourites, but build-up to this year's contest focused on Israel's inclusion, seen by many as controversial due to Israel's military action in Gaza. Iceland, Ireland, the Netherlands, Slovenia and Spain didn't enter as a result. Israel had also denied allegations that it broke Eurovision rules last year, accused of using state-run social media accounts to encourage people to use all 10 of their votes on its song. As for the UK, electronic artist Lutmum No Computer's song Eins Zwei Drei stretches the country's winless run to 29 years, with Bulgaria winning the right to host in 2027. One of the most turbulent years in the competition's history draws to a close.
The government is exploring whether the north of England could host the Olympic and Paralympic Games. An assessment's been commissioned by UK Sport, which could lead to a bid in the 2040s. The process will look at the costs, benefits and likelihood of success of any application. Here's our sports correspondent, Patrick Geary.
It's 14 years since London 2012, British sport's great spectacular, and now the government wants the Games back. This time they've commissioned an assessment to look at holding the Olympics and Paralympics across the north of England. Lisa Nandy, the Culture Secretary who represents Wigan in Parliament, says the region has already shown it can host big sporting occasions and deserves to hold the Games. Any bid would aim to develop existing facilities rather than committing to spending big sums on new venues. The initial assessment could be followed by a feasibility study, but a final decision on whether to bid would be made by the British Olympic and Paralympic Associations.
One of Britain's best-loved sopranos, Dame Felicity Lott, has died at the age of 79. She announced earlier this month that she had terminal cancer. Dame Felicity made her operatic debut in 1974 and went on to perform at Glyndebourne and at concert halls around the world, singing works by composers including Mozart and Richard Strauss. She described herself as shy and gawky as a girl and says her attempt to be a teacher in France was derailed by nerves. Dame Felicity told Desert Island Discs she only became a singer by accident.
I had so much free time in between my attempts to teach, do English conversation, which was complete riot. And anyway, I went and enrolled at the Conservatoire in Grenoble and found a teacher there. She said if you were to do a little bit of work, maybe you could do something with singing.
Dame Felicity Lott. Well, now a look at the Sunday newspapers, and the Sunday Telegraph warns that Britain's Brexit wounds could be reopened because it says both Andy Burnham and his leadership rival Wes Streeting favour Britain rejoining the European Union. The paper understands that Reform UK will make Brexit betrayal a theme of its by-election campaign in Makerfield. The Sunday Times says Mr. Streeting's announcement that he wanted to rejoin the EU had electrified the race to succeed Sir Keir Starmer. It says his words signal an end to what it calls the long-standing omerta among senior Labour figures who want to see closer alignment with Brussels. Andy Burnham has spoken to the Sunday Mirror in what it calls his first in-depth interview since he declared his plan to return to Parliament. It says he has laid out his vision for the country and that a Burnham administration would take stronger public control of essentials such as energy and water, introduce proportional representation, and greatly increase the number of council houses built. The Mirror says the need to unify the left is urgent. The Observer describes the Prime Minister attacking Wes Streeting by telling insiders that the Health Secretary damaged the government when he never had a plan to win any leadership ballot. The paper also claims that Sir Keir's relationship with the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, has been gravely damaged by recent events, saying Mr. Miliband chose not to urge the party's soft left to support Number 10 when the challenges emerged to the Prime Minister's leadership. Dan Hodges writes in the Mail on Sunday that Sir Keir Starmer has told close friends he intends to stand down and set out a timetable for his departure. The cabinet minister is quoted in the article as saying he realises the current chaos is unsustainable and will leave in a manner of his own choosing. The Sunday Express claims that Iranian spying operations on UK soil are responsible for the highest number of hostile state activity investigations. A senior counter-terror officer tells the paper that there are record levels of investigative casework on terror plots, espionage, and state-level threats to individuals. And The Sun on Sunday says that armed police protecting the royal family have been accused of falling asleep on the job. The paper says dozens of officers are being investigated, and it says that it's also been claimed that some clocked on then failed to attend their posts. Sources tell The Sun it's embarrassing. The Met has told the paper it's launched an urgent investigation to look into the allegations. I'll look at some of Sunday's papers.
Many thanks, Charles Carroll. This is BBC Radio 4. Time now for Sunday worship from the Hoddinott Hall in Cardiff with the National Chorus of Wales.
Thank you. Welcome to Sunday Worship from Hoddinott Hall in Cardiff, part of the Wider Wales Millennium Centre and home to the National Chorus of Wales. We've just heard them singing Vaughan Williams' setting of George Herbert's hymn, Let All the World in Every Corner Sing. They will be leading our music throughout this service, and as someone who regularly attends concerts in the Hoddinott Hall, I know that we're in for a real treat. My name is Stephen Wigley. I'm a Methodist minister based in Cardiff, and sharing in this service, I'll be joined by my colleague, Reverend Cathy Gale, the Superintendent Minister of the Cardiff Methodist Circuit. Indeed, it's Cathy who will now lead us in our opening prayers.
Let us pray. Lord, our God, King of heaven, all glory and power belong to you. Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, ascended, Lord, all glory and power belong to you. Holy Spirit, witness that Jesus is alive. All glory and power belong to you. Great God, glorious and holy, we praise you for all that brings heaven to earth for us, for word and sacrament, for faithful Christians past and present, for fellowship within and beyond the church, and for times of deep awareness that Jesus is still with us. All glory and power belong to you, our Lord and our God. Amen. Almighty God, forgive us that we so often confine our attention to this world and its needs, and we forget the bigger picture. Forget your all-embracing love and power. Forgive us when we attempt to hold you for ourselves and neglect to share your love with others. Forgive us for our poor discipleship and our unwillingness to let you shine in our lives. Give us a vision of your glory that inspires us to be your servants, channels of your grace to others. Help us to live our lives for your glory. We ask this in the name of Jesus, who taught us when we pray to say, Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Today is the Sunday after Ascension, that momentous day in the church calendar which comes 40 days after Easter and marks the moment when the risen Jesus bids farewell to his disciples. They are still coming to terms with his resurrection from the dead. So Jesus opens their minds to understand the scriptures and tells them to stay in Jerusalem until they've been clothed with power from on high. He blesses them, and while blessing, withdraws to be carried up to heaven. We shall hear two accounts of these events, as told at the very end of Luke's Gospel, and then as picked up at the beginning of the Acts of the Apostles. These two accounts come together as a kind of hinge, holding the two parts of the story of Jesus together. In Luke's Gospel, we see the account of all that Jesus said and did in his physical body on earth to proclaim the gospel until his death and resurrection in Jerusalem. Then, in the Acts of the Apostles, we hear how, as the risen body of Jesus ascends to be with his Father in heaven, the Holy Spirit comes as promised upon the disciples at Pentecost, enabling them to continue Jesus' ministry as his spiritual body on earth. Taken together, these accounts of Jesus' ascension envisage a kind of twofold movement. First, heavenwards, as the risen Jesus ascends to be with his Father in heaven, but also back down to earth, as his revitalized disciples seek to continue their ministry in Jesus' name. In our service today, we're going to delve a little more into these two movements, the one heavenwards and the other down to earth, and see how both are crucial to Christian faith. But first, we hear a reading of the psalm appointed for today, Psalm 47, which, like George Herbert's hymn, encourages us to sing praises to God, who is the King of all the earth.
Clap your hands, all you peoples. Shout to God with loud songs of joy. For the Lord the Most High is awesome, a great King over all the earth. He subdued peoples under us and nations under our feet. He chose our heritage for us, the pride of Jacob, whom he loves. God has gone up with a shout, the Lord with the sound of a trumpet. Sing praises to God. Sing praises. Sing praises to our King. Sing praises, for God is the King of all the earth. Sing praises with a psalm. God is King over the nations. God sits on his holy throne. The princes of the peoples gather as the people of the God of Abraham. For the shields of the earth belong to God. He is highly exalted.
That was Charles Wesley's hymn, Christ Whose Glory Fills the Skies. Our next reading is the account of Jesus' farewell and ascension, as it is told at the very end of Luke's Gospel, in chapter 24, verses 44 to 53.
Then Jesus said to them, "These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms must be fulfilled." Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures, and he said to them, "Thus it is written, that the Messiah is to suffer and rise from the dead on the third day, and that repentance and forgiveness of sins is to be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning from Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. And see, I am sending upon you what my Father promised. So stay here in the city until you have been clothed with power from on high." Then he led them out as far as Bethany, and lifting up his hands, he blessed them. While he was blessing them, he withdrew from them and was carried up into heaven. And they worshipped him and returned to Jerusalem with great joy, and they were continually in the temple, blessing God.
There's an old-fashioned phrase sometimes used to describe someone's passing, that he or she has gone to glory. It carries the sense that whoever has died has kept the faith and can now anticipate meeting God face to face. It's part of what St. Paul describes as being changed from one degree of glory to another, which Charles Wesley sets out in the closing verse of his great hymn, Love Divine. Change from glory into glory, till in heaven we take our place. Glory is a key theme in the Bible and in the life and ministry of Jesus, especially as it's told in John's Gospel. However, more recently, and perhaps mindful of its complex relationship with power, the Church can appear a little uncomfortable with it. The 20th century Catholic theologian Hans-Urs von Balthasar was one who considered that, in its understandable concern to make the gospel message relevant and meaningful to the world, the Church had lost some of its focus on the glory of God. In his own work, he sought to redress the balance. The first part of his great trilogy was entitled The Glory of the Lord, and set out his attempt to recover a sense of the joy and beauty of God. In particular, an attempt to interpret the Bible from the perspective of glory. One response to such a challenge could be a renewed focus on worship and sacraments, on the importance of our offering our very best in the service of God. But it would be a mistake to focus on glory purely in terms of aesthetics, a fine vestment, splendid liturgies, and cathedral-like churches which lift our eyes to the heavens. After all, that was not the experience of Jesus in his earthly ministry. And when challenged by the impact of fine buildings in Jerusalem, his response was to say that it wouldn't be long before they all came tumbling down. Jesus' ascension to be with his Father marks the vindication of all he'd undergone throughout his ministry on earth. Not just the times of acclamation and praise with the disciples and crowds, but also in the quiet moments of disappointment and desolation. Indeed, in John's Gospel, it is precisely as Judas leaves the Last Supper in the upper room to betray him that Jesus says, "Now the Son of Man has been glorified, and God has been glorified in him." To give God the glory is not simply about the aesthetics of worship. It can be found in the way Jesus' disciples discover the strength needed to take up their own cross to follow him, the way they seek to love their fellow disciples as Jesus first loved them, and the way they offer their gifts and graces to be used in the service of Christ's church. It's not the glory of being raised into the heavens. It's the glory which focuses instead on care for God's world and the people within it. That's the glory which Jesus takes with him to his Father. That's the glory to which his disciples are called, as we shall explore the next part of our service. But for now, we continue with George Bourne's hymn, Lord Enthroned in Heavenly Splendor, and its triumphal closing line, Alleluia, Alleluia, Risen, Ascended, Glorified.
Yeah.
accept the account of Jesus' ascension as it is told right at the beginning of the Acts of the Apostles, in chapter 1, verses 1 to 11.
In the first book, Theophilus, I wrote about all that Jesus began to do and teach until the day he was taken up to heaven, after giving instructions through the Holy Spirit to the apostles whom he had chosen. After his suffering, he presented himself alive to them by many convincing proofs, appearing to them during 40 days and speaking about the kingdom of God. While he stayed with them, he ordered them not to leave Jerusalem, but to wait there for the promise of the Father. So, when they had come together, they asked him, Lord, is this the time when you will restore the kingdom to Israel? He replied, It is not for you to know the times or periods that the Father has set by his own authority. But you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, in all Judea and Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. When he had said this, as they were watching, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. While he was going and they were gazing up toward heaven, suddenly two men in white robes stood by them. They said, Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking up toward heaven? This Jesus, who has been taken up from you into heaven, will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven.
Men of Galilee, why do you stand gazing into heaven? Whenever I read this passage, I'm taken back to my first appointment in Swansea. Outside a local church was a wayside pulpit notice board, and I was often held up in the traffic and given good time to read it. There were various messages, some of which could be quite cheesy, but one I remember distinctly raised a similar question. Is your faith too heavenly-minded to be any earthly good? The image of Jesus addressing his disciples before ascending to be with his Father with his feet in the clouds would appear to raise just this question. I can remember on past holidays to Italy seeing various depictions of the Ascension by Raphael and Perugino, for example. Pretty and colourful they are, yet they nevertheless give the impression that what is happening up in the clouds in heaven remains very far removed from events and people down on earth. But as we've been exploring in this service, it may actually be the opposite which is true. That it's the physical body of Jesus being raised into heaven which allows and creates the space for his followers to become the spiritual body of Christ on earth, alive and at work in the power of his Spirit. After all, that's what the final message of Jesus is to his disciples, that they are to wait in Jerusalem until they've been clothed with fire from above. That's what happens when the Holy Spirit comes as a mighty wind and in tongues of fire on the day of Pentecost, which Christians will celebrate next Sunday. It's not just that Peter and his fellow disciples find themselves saying and doing precisely those things which they were too scared to do when the earthly Jesus was still with them. It's that, with the inspiration of others like Paul, they find themselves being led to proclaim and live out the gospel in communities right across the Mediterranean world. The ascension of Jesus into heaven enables the space for the apostles to bring the Church of Christ into life on earth as the community which shares his life and reveals his love to the world. And ultimately, that reveals something too about the glory of God. There's a famous saying by one of the early church fathers, Bishop Irenaeus of Lyon, that the glory of God is a human being fully alive. As we reflect on the story of the Ascension, we're reminded that going to glory is not just about what happens when Jesus goes to be with his Father. It's about how our lives can be set alight in the power of the Spirit to become part of his risen body, alive and at work in the world. The theme of the glory of God being revealed in loving service is one which is picked up in our next hymn, Brother, sister, let me serve you. Let me be as Christ to you. After which Kathy will find out more about a local project which is doing just that.
This service comes from the Hoddinott Hall in the Millennium Centre, set in the transformed Cardiff Bay area. Just a couple of miles away, another part of the city is also changing, Adamsdown. Here we find another story of death and new life in the work of the Trinity Centre. Based in a refurbished former Methodist church, the centre has become a hub for groups and organisations serving the local community. Its activities range from arts and crafts and well-being sessions to shared cooking, eating and providing safe, welcoming spaces where families and children can relax, have fun and make new friends. I'd like to introduce Laura Evans, a member of the executive body overseeing the Trinity Centre, a project of the Methodist Church in Cardiff. Laura grew up worshipping with her family in the Trinity congregation, which stopped meeting just over a decade ago. Yet the work that began in the building, initially supporting people seeking refuge and asylum, has continued to grow into a much broader mission. Laura, tell us what's been happening at Trinity recently.
Well, the Trinity building, it had become really quite run down and dilapidated over a number of years. We talked about being a place of welcome, and we were. But the problem was that the whole outlook of the building didn't really reflect that. And yet people still gathered there, people still felt safe there. So we began to start looking at how we could refurbish this large Grade 2 listed church in a way that said to both the people who used it and also to the surrounding community that they were loved and valued by God and by us.
So how did you achieve that? Grade 2 listed buildings are not easy to refurbish.
No, indeed, they're really not.
A lot of work was done by some very awesome people to apply for grants and to fundraise generally, and we were blessed by the response of a number of major funders, but also of individuals invested in the project. So that a year ago, we relaunched a resurrected centre, which is now open and welcoming and fit for the purpose for which it was designed.
What has been the response?
Can I share what happened at our opening event? It was basically a sort of open house type thing with food and various things going on. We planned for 100 people and 400 came. All kinds of people, many of them refugees and asylum seekers who wanted to see how things had changed and who were looking forward to coming back into the centre with their groups. But there were also new people, people from the local community, who were just curious to find out about what was going on inside that building. It was difficult for people to be curious when there were two big wooden doors which looked like they were trying to keep people out. But now we've got a glass front with plants in the windows and the building just sort of draws you in. And then there were the church people, many of whom had been distressed when our congregation stopped meeting there, but who could now see it as a new life of service in a place that they loved.
And so a year on, are still things good?
Oh, they are so, so good. The established groups have come back to meet at Trinity, but there are new things as well. There's a women's space on a Friday called the Sisterhood Cafe and a free community lunch on a Tuesday called Welcome Table. And all of these are enabled by a band of volunteers from different sectors of society. It's a wonderful multi-ethnic, multi-faith group. And there is always so much laughter and noise and food there. It really is the love of Christ in action.
That was Maurice de Rouffle's motet, Ubi Caritas, where charity and love are, God is. And now let us pray. Thank you, Lord, for your word and the stories the Bible tells us of what happened after you were risen and ascended, how your followers began to live out their commitment to you without you physically present with them. Thank you for the stories of how they overcame fear and doubt and began to live boldly and openly, sharing your love with others.
Help us, as your followers today, to reflect your glory as they did. Help us to look for opportunities to do good, to care for those who struggle from day to day. And may we reach out further, in prayer and in action, to support those across the world who are suffering from the effects of war, of violent action, of climate change or injustice. Lord Jesus, your Holy Spirit empowers us to continue your work of love and care. May we let our light shine in whatever ways we can, both big and small. We ask this in your name, Lord. Amen.
Was the National Chorus of Wales singing Hugh Sherlock's hymn, Lord, Thy Church on Earth is Seeking Thy Renewal from Above. We thank you for joining us in this service from the Hoddenot Hall in Cardiff. And may the blessing of God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit rest upon us and remain with us evermore. Amen.
That was Jonathan Hope playing Postlude in G on a theme of Gibbons. The service was led by the Reverend Stephen Wigley and Reverend Kathy Gale, and the National Chorus of Wales was conducted by Adrian Partington. The producer was Jonathan Thomas. Next week, Sunday worship is a service for Pentecost Sunday from Alive City Church in London.
On BBC iPlayer.
I'm proud of this casino.
We're £9,000 down this month. Someone's been stealing.
Starring Sheridan Smith and Michael Socha.
What are you doing here?
What are you doing here?
The odds are stacked against them.
I'll get your money.
No, you won't.
I think you've got problems.
I have got problems. I'm going to be kicked out on the street.
The Cage.
He lies. He should know that if you're his girlfriend.
I'm not his girlfriend.
All right, I'm standing here.
Watch all episodes on BBC iPlayer.
Now on BBC Radio 4, history told by the people who were there. It's Witness History, presented by Jane Wilkinson, who's taking us back to World War II with a classic whodunit to explain how one of the most popular board games was invented.
We are gathered here because a murder has been committed.
But it wasn't by Colonel Mustard in the library with the candlestick. Instead, let's turn detective for a visit to a 1930s English country house where a group of partygoers have gathered. And it's the man playing the piano who's our main suspect for creating Cluedo.
He was a wonderful pianist. When he was a young man, he would play the piano in hotels and country houses. There was often murder mystery games. There's a body discovered, and then it's a process of elimination and questioning. People would go absolutely wild and a lot of shrieking and screaming. He found that quite fascinating.
This is Marcia Lewis, and it's her dad, Anthony Pratt, who's at the piano keys. And murder mystery games are not his only brush with the world of crime.
He's spent the best part of a year playing the piano at a hotel. One frequent visitor to this hotel was a retired Crown Court judge known as the Hanging Judge. And he used to hold court, regaling visitors with all the criminals that he'd tried. And I think that made a very big impression on my dad, who was listening in.
So the evidence against Anthony is stacking up. But before our suspect could plan the perfect board game, war breaks out.
He was too old for national service, but he did work in a munitions factory in Birmingham, making turrets for tanks. Birmingham was a great target for enemy bombing. So the blackouts were imposed very, very strictly. The evenings were spent behind blacked out windows and social life came to a halt. So my dad did have time on his hands to think.
And now, with both the means and the opportunity, Anthony dreams up a plot.
The rules of the game are what my dad got the patent for. It's like a detective novel translated into a board game. Somebody's murdered, there's a limited pool of suspects and a crime scene, and the suspects are systematically eliminated to leave one, the murderer, who's then arrested.
Of course, every murder mystery needs a grand backdrop. Meet our next suspect in the creation of Cluedo, Elva Pratt, Anthony's wife.
Her biggest contribution was the design of the board. She was a talented amateur artist, so the actual representation of the board was entirely her work. All the classic rooms that you would get in a country house. A ballroom, a conservatory, a dining room, library, and a billiard room.
But, according to Marcia, any talk of the game's Tudor mansion being based on a real house is simply a red herring.
There's two in particular often mentioned. One is Highbury Hall in Birmingham. And then the other one was Tudor Close Hotel in Sussex, which attracted film stars, the sort of upper echelons of society. But my parents didn't mix in those circles. So the game was an amalgam of country houses that they'd seen or knew about.
Next to be introduced to the game are a cast of characters. And they're not all the usual suspects.
In the original, there was Dr. Black, Mr. Brown, Mr. Gold, Professor Plum, Miss Scarlet. There was Colonel Yellow, who became Colonel Mustard. Mrs. White was originally Nurse White, and in the American version, Reverend Green was just plain Mr. Green because apparently it wasn't acceptable to have a member of the clergy mixed up in murder.
Whatever the identity of the killer, Anthony provides them with a choice of weapons.
The original included an axe, a bottle of poison, a poker, and a hypodermic syringe, and a bomb. Which would be rather obvious.
Yes. Yeah, if you bombed the billiard room.
That's right. So they did change that in the final version.
With the scene set for murder, Anthony and Elva must now make sure the game works. Each player has to move around the mansion to work out the killer, the weapon, and the room where the crime took place.
They tested it out with friends, family, who were only too glad to come along in the evenings during the war because it meant they had an entertaining evening when they'd just otherwise be listening to the wireless and looking at four walls.
And one of those friends is a neighbour called Geoffrey Bull, who'd previously invented the game Buccaneer. In 1943, he introduces Anthony to the manufacturer Waddington's.
It was immediate interest. They said that the more they played it, the more they liked it, and that they would take it up.
But first, the cast is trimmed to six, and the weapons updated. There are now 324 possible solutions, but there's something the company just doesn't like.
My dad, he called it, not very imaginatively, murder with two exclamation marks. I suppose they felt Cluedo would be a much catchier title. It's a combination of Clue, which, of course, is what the game's about, and Ludo, from the Latin, I play. My dad, he admitted it changed for the better.
The war and a shortage of materials delay the game's launch, and it's not until December 1949 that it appears on the shelves.
It was produced in quite a small black and white, but not ostentatious or eye-catching box.
But if Anthony's motive was money, the murder game doesn't quite make him a killing.
In 1953, Waddington's offered my dad £5,000 for the overseas rights to the sales. They had told him that they were very disappointed in the sales figures overseas, particularly America. Now, in 1953, £5,000 would have bought two respectable houses and a car. So he probably thought it was the responsible thing to do. But he had no way of knowing just what a phenomenon it would become. And it was that 1960s version, coloured red, with a figure of Sherlock Holmes on the front, which really increased the sales dramatically.
Since its launch, more than 150 million copies have been sold around the world, including in the US, where it's known as Clue. Why is it so popular? Well, here's Marcia's hunch.
Most of the population then and now, they're interested in murder mystery games. There are versions on the television, aren't there, with traitors? It is a lovely legacy. They've left a source of fun and entertainment for the whole family.
So who did invent Cluedo? Well, from the evidence we've gathered, it was Mr. and Mrs. Pratt in their front room with a little imagination and some time on their hands.
Witness History was presented by Jane Wilkinson, and you can find more memorable moments from history told by the people who were there on BBC Sounds. Now, in Tweet of the Day, produced by Sophie Anton, Isabella Tree describes how the decline in nightingales might be reversed.
15 years ago, we began inviting friends over to hear nightingales at NEP, our home and rewilding project in West Sussex. Suddenly, nightingales were popping up in the thickets of scrub that had begun to cover our old arable fields. Today, we have around 60 singing males a year, around 1% of the UK population. We go out after dinner when it's properly dark and just stand amongst the hawthorn, blackthorn and bramble and listen. Sometimes you can hear four or five nightingales competing in one patch, throwing their songs to the starry sky hoping to attract an overflying female, following them from Africa. Most of our friends and guests have never heard one. Often they find the experience overwhelming. Nightingales were once common, but are now one of the UK's rarest birds. Their behaviour at NEP, though, is showing how we might reverse that. Nightingales used to be associated with coppiced woodland, but at NEP they're thriving in dense, thorny scrub. Protection for their nests, which they build only